right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, and it is Monday morning. We're here till 5 a.m. Yeah. And Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're also going to review all the new movies with Jim Leskowski and Eric Childress. And we'll talk about the box office as we do every Monday morning. Rod Pyle is going to join us this morning. We're very excited. Rod is an award-winning author. He's a filmmaker and he's a speaker and an expert on space. He's got a bunch of great space books that we're going to talk about. But he wanted to jump in here and talk about the Super Blood Wolf Moon, which is the first total lunar eclipse in 3 years. And we'll talk about that and much more. And there are other space stories that Rod's going to get to here, and we will talk about that. He'll be joining us after the 2:30 news. Rod's also a big fan of science fiction movies and sci-fi and stuff. And so Nerdist ranked all the Star Trek movies. So we're going to talk about all the Star Trek movies. That'll be coming up a little bit later on. And also, we'll tell you what you can do and how you can celebrate MLK Day today. Our phone number, as always, is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can also follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, and it's facebook.com/Nick D Show. And also, subscribe to our podcast. If you can't listen live, I know some people aren't up at 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. But if you subscribe to the podcast, it's free. You go to iTunes or wherever you get podcasts, subscribe. Every second of each show is podcast, and then you can listen at your leisure, bro, and it'll automatically be sent to your device. So that's what's happening on the show this morning, and let me say hello to my great producer, Dan Shugrue. Hi, Dan.
Howdy, Nick.
How are you?
All right, man. How about yourself?
I'm all right. Not bad. Hibernated all weekend.
Sure. Good time to do it.
Yeah. Just, we were going to go to the movies on Saturday, but then, of course, that the weather got all funky. So, my parents stayed in, I stayed in and watched a lot of TV over the weekend and tried to stay warm. So, and we'll continue to do that because it's going to be cold for the next next few days.
Yeah.
So, anyway, your weekend okay?
Yeah, it was good. Much like you, kind of hunkered down pretty much the entirety of it, with the exception of Eileen's niece coming over for a sleepover.
Right, right.
And so that was fun. And then Sunday, the weather obviously had broken up enough that we were able to head to my parents and celebrate the ladies in our life. My mom, my wife, my sister-in-law, and my brother's girlfriend all have birthdays within the span of a week and a half of each other. So we got to celebrate them.
That's nice. Isn't that the same in November? Don't you have a lot of birthdays in November?
Yeah.
Because I know you.
Right. We have 4 days in a row of birthdays. So. And we had the same thing in December, and I believe also in March, maybe, or April. So,
all right.
Lots of
clusters of birthdays.
Yes, exactly.
All right, cool. All right, that's Dan Shugrue. He's producing. And in the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
I'm doing very well.
Yeah? How was your weekend?
I did kind of the same. We hunkered down and stayed inside, other than one trip to the grocery store all weekend. We canceled our trip to Wisconsin.
Oh, you did, huh?
Yeah, so... But, you know, it turned out to be nice. We got some quality time and definitely got some Netflix going on over the weekend.
Ah, there you go. That's what you got to do. You know, it's interesting because when we were talking about your trip to Wisconsin on Friday, that storm shifted.
It did, yeah.
It shifted and it went north.
North, yeah. That's when we were really on the phone kind of late into the night, you know, the whole family, and we all decided just wasn't going to be safe.
You don't want to be out in that, you know. You don't want to be driving in that. And you never know, because, I mean, when we were talking about the forecast on Friday, it was not supposed to go north. And it did. It shifted completely.
Right.
It shifted completely.
So I told Jeannie that I said, I will go with you, but just know that my life is in your hands. I'm only going for you. So if you want to do that.
Oh, man.
She was a little frustrated because it was her trip, really.
Yeah, you know?
But anyway.
Nice way to make her feel guilty.
Right.
You know,
and I think I even said, as I'm walking away, and I have kids. So. So that's, it was shortly after that she made her decision and texted everybody.
I bet. That's pretty funny, man. That is pretty funny. Well, I'm glad everybody is safe and stay warm, everybody. It's chilly out there this morning. So anyway, 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text anytime you want to jump in here. And we are going to jump in the Star Trek. Now, Dan, have you seen all the Star Trek movies?
I have not. I've only seen the new ones.
So, like the old, the
I've never seen from whether the original TV show cast or the Next Generation cast. I have not seen any of those.
Wow. Yeah, we were talking about this because you've never seen Wrath of Khan.
Right.
But we'll talk about that. But you saw the J.J. Abrams.
I did see the J.J. Abrams one.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll get into all of those. That was Nerdist. Put together this article and wrote about it. It'll be a lot of fun to talk about the Star Trek movies. I don't think we've ever actually just specifically talked about the Star Trek films before. And there's a bunch of them, so there's a lot to talk about. And we want to hear from you guys. If you're a Star Trek fan, which ones are your favorites? And which ones are the best or which ones are the worst? We'll jump into that and talk about that a little bit later. And that'll be after we talk to Rod Pyle, who is a big sci-fi freak. And I'll have to ask Rod what his favorite Star Trek movie is. I have no doubt in my mind it'll be Wrath of Khan. No doubt in my mind it'll be Wrath of Khan. So anyway, that's coming up on the show, so stay tuned. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. When we take a break here, we'll come back. Jim Leskowski and Eric Childress are going to join me to talk all things movie on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Yeah, and Rod Pyle is going to join us, our space guy, to talk about the Blood Moon and much more. All right here on 720 WGN. We're also going to rank the Star Trek movies, all of them. Right after we talk space with Rod. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And it is Monday, so that means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Jim Leskowski and Eric Childress join me each week to talk about the new movies. And let's jump right into that. We'll review all the new ones here. And here's Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
All right. And Jim. Welcome back, Jim.
Hey, man. It's nice to be back. Hope you're keeping warm out there.
Yeah, it's pretty chilly out there, man. So,
indeed.
Yeah. So not a ton of movies to talk about this week. Only one really big one opened up. And then we'll do the box office as well. Eric, when do you leave for Sundance?
Thursday. This Thursday.
Okay, this coming Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And we'll get a couple of reports from you, right? That's from Sundance?
Yeah.
Okay,
yep.
Cool. What are you looking forward to?
Oh, boy. There's a new film from the director of The Overnight, Patrick Bryce. It's called Corporate Animals with Ed Helms and Demi Moore. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a weekend retreat that goes wrong in a cave or some weird thing like that. That looks like it could be a lot of fun. There's a new an adaptation of Native Son, the book Native Son, set here in Chicago, that I'm going to be seeing on opening night. I'm looking forward to that. There's also a new documentary about the making of Alien.
Oh, no,
that's
going
to be premiering there.
Wow.
Yeah, from the director, the documentary filmmaker who did The People versus George Lucas.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it's called Memory, the Origins of Alien.
Wow. Now, what do we know about that? I mean, did he get everybody? Is, like, Ridley Scott involved? And
that I don't know. I honestly don't know. It was one of the first things that was announced. I know the people that are handling it, and I know it like goes all the way back to like you know the Dan O'Bannon days, and exactly. So I'm sure Dark Star is probably going to show up in there. I imagine.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping. You know, I hope it's pretty comprehensive. I mean, that guy has done some good work.
Yeah.
Alexandrio Felipe is his name. So. Really looking forward to that. That's going to be opening night as well.
All right, very cool. That's a great topic for a documentary.
Most certainly.
I mean, you know, it's such a legendary movie, and you know, So, well, that sounds cool. All right, so Sundance, you'll be leaving on Thursday to go to Sundance, So there we go. Let's get started.
Mm-hmm.
Jim, why don't you tell us about Cold War?
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah, this is the newest film from a very fascinating Polish director named Paweł Pawlikowski, I believe. And this is the official submission from Poland to the Academy Awards this year for best foreign language film, and it's won a lot of acclaim. So we follow a man named Victor, played by Thomas Kott, I believe, and he's in charge of sort of maintaining and directing this flourishing music company, and he's recruited to audition and select a troupe of singers and dancers to perform in a series of various stage shows. And in walks the luminous Joanna Kulig as Zula, who is one of the singers and dancers who comes to audition. And I believe this takes place in Poland in about the late 40s, if I'm not mistaken, but it sort of jumps forward and backwards in time as well. So whomever is selected for this music company will go through kind of a lot of rigorous rehearsal and train intensively in this old chateau. Meanwhile, of course, war continues to break out, and both Victor and Zula become closer than close. And, you know, despite the surrounding difficulties of the culture and environment around them, they develop a very intense relationship, and we witness their affair as it jumps kind of forward several years, with, you know, sort of experiencing their different feelings at different times, and just seeing how they survive and thrive during a lot of war-torn country falling apart. And, you know, it focuses also on a lot of live performance, and by the mid-1950s, this troupe sort of becomes internationally famous and invited to perform in the Soviet Union. And on a trip to Berlin, Victor sort of plans their escape so they can sort of just be together and not have to worry about all the things going on around them. But, of course, things happen to intervene. And the two of them essentially may or may not end up together, sort of as doomed partners, akin to kind of Bogart and Bacall. But this film definitely seems to echo and emulate Casablanca in a lot of ways. But at the same time, it's a very simple story, a very simple love story that's sort of just really enveloping due to its style. This director really trusts the audience to sort of fill in the gaps, because, you know, the story here is told in this really understated, beautiful way. It's kind of this old-fashioned romance between two very different people. But it's also apparently very representative of what the director knew regarding his own parents and what they went through to various degrees. But this is a very lush and striking film, from the performances to this sort of 4:3 aspect ratio and breathtaking black and white cinematography. And the use of music in here is just pretty remarkable, whether it's sung or classical music or even pop hits. There's a really great moment involving Rock Around the Clock that sort of stands out. And it also breezes by in about 88 minutes. I mean, for me, I think this is a pretty special film. I mean, the ending is a little abrupt, but I found myself really engrossed by it. It's not like a movie that I think will be coming out later this year called Transit, that also sort of takes place during a tumultuous time in Europe and involves two very different people sort of experiencing love in the face of circumstances, very difficult circumstances in war. So I'm a huge fan of this director. The last film he made was called Ida, and he did a really good film early in his career with Emily Blunt called My Summer of Love. He's just really good at telling simple love stories, but in really interesting ways that are just kind of awe-inspiring at times with how he visually tells a story. There are definite cultural and socio-political tensions that sort of expand here, obviously, due to the time and, of course, the title of the film itself. I mean, for me, I just think this is one of the more interesting relationship studies, and it was actually number 18 on my list of favorite films for last year. So I absolutely recommend people checking it out if they can, especially on the big screen, because it's a gorgeous film.
Okay, that's Cold War. It's playing at the River East down here and at the Century in Evanston. So those two theaters are showing Cold War. Jim, you mentioned your favorite films of the year. You want to run down your list real quick, your top 10?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no problem. For me, I always have a choice for number one, but I'm going to go through them here. And number 10 was Shoplifters. Number 9, The Writer. Number 8, of course, is Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, which, of course, everybody loves, and as well they should. Number 7 is Minding the Gap. Number 6 is Madeline's Madeline, a very interesting independent feature that is very challenging, and I wish people would seek that one out more. Number 5 is The Favorite. Number 4 is Hereditary. Number 3 is If Beale Street Could Talk. Number 2 is Blindspotting. And for me, number 1 is a film I actually got to review on your show here, is Burning. A movie that really snuck up on me more and more the more I thought about it. I just thought it was a remarkable film from this from South Korea.
All right. Well, there you go. We also have a we had our list. We did our list a couple of weeks ago, and all three of us, Eric and Colin and I, all chose Roma as our best film. And that was the first time that's happened, Eric, since
Fury Road,
when all three of us have had the same movie at number one. So, next week, Jim, it's just going to be me and you because Eric's going to be in Sundance. We'll get a report from Eric. But we'll handle the reviews. There's not a ton of movies to review next week either. But I know that you're going to come up with a list of like underrated 80s movies for next week.
Yeah, it's interesting too because every year now, Eric, Colin, and I we do this podcast where we sort of do a retrospective and we go back 30 years. So this year, obviously, we're covering 1989, and we're going to talk about all the movies that came out that year. And I just recently rewatched Johnny Handsome, and it made me start thinking about there are a lot of really great underrated 80s movies, and I was going to put together a quick list for us to talk about. I think that'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we'll do that. I can't believe Johnny Handsome's 30 years old. It's crazy. I mean, yeah, Do the Right Thing is 30 years old.
Mm-hmm. Man. Yeah, that's wild.
Jeez. Well, we'll talk about that next week when we can feel nice and old.
Sure.
All right, a couple more movies to review here, and Eric, you and I will go over the box office as well. So, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress and Jim Leskowski reviewing the new movies with me, and Eric is going off to Sundance on Thursday, and we'll get some reports from there from him. Okay, a couple more movies to review, but we got a break here for the news right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We got a Blackhawks Express, a fun Blackhawks Express to play back from yesterday's game. We are also going to be talking about Star Trek movies. Our good friend Rod Pyle is going to join us to talk about the Blood Moon and more space-related issues. And also we'll tell you how you can celebrate MLK Day today. So all that coming up and more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. It is Monday, and that means that the movie reviews happen every Monday morning. Jim Leskowski and Eric Childress join me to review the new movies. Here is Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hi there.
All right. Eric, tell us about The Standoff at Sparrow Creek.
Okay, this is a film that I saw back at the Toronto Film Festival last September. I don't remember if we talked about this one or not, but it's a directorial debut of a guy named Henry Dunham, I believe is his
name. Yeah.
Dunham. And it's the story of the beginning of the movie, a police funeral has been terrorized by someone as part of a local militia. They have shot up the place. They have killed a number of police officers, and the cops are now on the lookout for who this person was. Well, as the movie also opens, we get to meet the members of the local militia who are all gathering at their compound, basically, to figure out exactly if one of their members is the person responsible for shooting this up. Obviously, this is of great concern to them, not so much that they don't agree with what they've done, but the fact that, you know, doing something like this puts them at complete risk. And, you know, cops won't just be after the one guy, they'll be after the entire crew. One of the members is played by James Badge Dale, who also happens to be an ex-cop. And as everyone gathers there, they discover that a gun is indeed missing. He is basically put in charge of interrogating everyone and trying to figure out exactly if he can break down if one of these guys is responsible for it. Also part of the crew, Brian Garrity, who plays, I don't want to tell you too much about who he plays. He's just a member of the militia. The leader of the militia, and this is to me just great casting, Chris Mulkey, who is a character actor that has been around since the 1980s, maybe even earlier than that.
He's been around forever. Mulkey.
Yeah. Seriously. Yeah. He was like in every, you know, I probably guarantee that, you know, when Jim brings up one of these underrated 80s movies next week, Chris Mulkey's probably in it.
Yeah.
And he plays the leader of the militia. And it's, you know, so you have a kind of a Reservoir Dogs like scenario. And if, you know, another potential Tarantino ripoff sounds like something that you might not be that interested in, let me, you know, persuade you otherwise, because this is actually one of the better, you know, films in that respect. It certainly has, you know, Reservoir Dogs' tendencies throughout, you know, exactly who is the mole, or, you know, in this case, who is the killer amongst them, if there is one. But the dialogue in the film, while Tarantino certainly has his own style, the dialogue in the film is actually a lot more in tune with David Mamet. And there's the interrogation scenes with Badge Dale are particularly striking. James Badge Dale, who I think he had like 3 or 4 films at Toronto last year, including the Jeremy Saulnier's new film Hold the Dark on Netflix. And I think he's the best thing in that. This guy is someone that I want to see more and more of, because he's got a great presence. He holds the screen so well. He's terrific in this movie. And, you know, ultimately, you know, while you're trying to figure out, you know, exactly, you know, who the bad guy is, even though they're all basically bad guys, there's something really kind of satiric going on about, you know, things that are going on in this country, but about basically idiots who will believe anything. And that really sort of kind of slyly rears its head throughout this movie. And it's a real sort of important underlying statement that's going on throughout this film. While in the meantime giving you like a really terrific mystery, a procedural, again, great dialogue, and James Badge Dale giving a performance that you're going to go, I want to see more of that guy. So the film is playing in like 1 or 2 theaters here in the Chicagoland area, but it's also available on VOD, I believe.
Yes, it is.
So you're going to want to check this one out, The Standoff at Sparrow Creek.
Standoff at Sparrow Creek. All right. Jim, what'd you think?
Oh, man. I dug this a lot. I've sort of been describing it to some people as, you know, Eric mentioned Reservoir Dogs. I also thought a little bit of The Thing and, you know, the work of Jeremy Saulnier and a little touch of Mamet here. So, I mean, this is totally up my alley. I love this type of sort of straightforward plot that manages to, again, much like Cold War, do a whole lot with its setup and characters, even if, you know, maybe how it all starts out and how it's set up, you know, kind of seems familiar, again, in that Reservoir Dogs sense, but the way things play out and the way these characters interact is consistently compelling. It's just this really interesting examination of doubt and uncertainty and dealing with fear among, you know, a group of men that, you know, have a tendency to react very violently at times, or at least get really intense with their emotions, and it has very little score, but just like a lot of tension and really great dialogue and memorable confrontations. And every single character here is very distinctive, and Eric's right in that I want to, you know, see more with this with James Batch Dale, and you know, you'll definitely recognize several of these character actors, including Chris Mulkey, and you know, it's just a really strong film that flies by. Again, it's another movie that's, you know, under 90 minutes, and you'll enjoy pretty much every interaction, and you'll also want to just know how things play out. You'll want to, you know, sort of piece together along with these characters on the screen this mystery. But yeah, I mean, I just this is how you do suspense and characterization in a way that brings you in and brings you closer. Unlike a certain other director we'll be getting to very shortly, I highly, highly recommend people seek this out at VOD. This is a really startlingly good debut film with some excellent character work by everyone here. So check it out, please.
All right. So that's The Standoff at Sparrow Creek. Eric, what do we know about this filmmaker? It's his first script, his first film.
Yeah, that basically it. Yeah, I mean, that's all I'm aware of. First thing he's cracked. I think he's made some short films prior to this, but yeah, this was, you know, you see, like, this is actually the first movie I saw Toronto last year. I got an advanced screener of it, and you know, sometimes you get movies like that, and you know, this, you know, it might seem like it might be getting thrown away, and this one absolutely wasn't. I mean, this was one of the real discoveries from Toronto last year, and I wish it wasn't coming out in January in the midst where it's going to get buried. I talked about a film called Small Town Crime on our Best Of show.
Yeah.
And that was another film that a great detective story with John Hawks that just got buried in January. I don't even know if they even got a VOD release back then, but Standoff, I think, is at least getting that much. But don't let this one pass you by, because you know, in the midst of a lot of really bad VOD films that's out there, this is really one of the standout ones.
Okay, that's The Standoff at Sparrow Creek. All right. Now, I wasn't even aware that there was a, what is this Dragon Ball Super Broly? What does that even mean?
Jim? I don't know anything about this world at all.
It's anime, Dragon Ball. You know, we had like a live action Dragon Ball film, Dragon Ball Evolution, a few years ago.
Yeah.
But this is purely an anime film. So I don't know. I honestly can't tell you anything about him. I've never seen a Dragon Ball film. I don't know. You know, it's just Pokemon for anime adults, I guess. I have no idea what these films and what the storyline is about.
Goku and Vegeta encounter Broly, a Saiyan warrior unlike any fighter they've faced before. There you go.
I'm surprised you didn't go see this, Nick. You went and saw that Pokemon movie, I remember.
Well, that was years ago. that completely freaked me out. I didn't know what the hell was going on when I was watching that thing. But I mean, it made money over the weekend.
It did very well.
I mean, what are we talking? We'll talk about it later. But wow, apparently there are.
Yeah,
there...
no, this is the story of the week, as far as I'm concerned.
Uh huh. Is this the...
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's the company that put it out is called Funimation, and they've been getting into the theatrical game a little bit more. I mean, they are kind of one of the, like, the premier home video market for all kinds of anime titles. But in the theatrical market, they put out the film Your Name last year, which was, you know, a pretty decent hit. They put out a lot of these Dragon Ball films and whatnot. A lot of them, you know, just kind of like one week or one night even events, Fathom events,
they've
done a lot of these things. Yeah. But, you know, this is an actual release. And when I saw, like, the first day numbers for this thing came in, I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
It is pretty impressive, the amount of money it made. We'll get to that. Get to that a little bit later on when we talk box office. So, interesting. Dragon Ball Super Broly.
Yeah.
Still have no idea what the hell the title means, but there you go. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress and Jim Laskowski are here. And when we come back, we get to review the new M. Night Shyamalan movie. So we will return right after this on 720 WGN. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because that's what we do on Monday morning. And coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. So there you go. All right. One more movie to talk about. Jim Laskowski and Eric Childress join me every Monday morning to talk movies. And let's welcome them back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right, Jim, tell us about Glass.
Okay. This is the latest from M. Night Shyamalan, who previously gave us, of course, and he had his breakthrough with The Sixth Sense. Then followed that one up with the first in a trilogy of a superhero saga, though didn't really know it was going to be a trilogy at the time. Unbreakable, that is, came out 19 years ago, whereas his last film, Split, was only a couple years ago, and it turns out that was the second chapter of his three-part saga. And Glass is supposedly the third and final chapter, as we follow these characters in the current state after the events of their respective films. We first find security expert David Dunn, played by Bruce Willis, on the hunt for the elusive and mysterious Kevin, played by James McAvoy, who battles multiple personality disorder, as we saw in Split. And it seems that he was never captured. So, of course, David, being the superhero of the film, has managed to track him down with the help of his now adult son. So we start off with a very intense, heated confrontation between hero and villain in an abandoned warehouse. But then both David and Kevin are captured by the authorities, only to be placed in the same institution as Elijah Price, a.k.a. Mr. Glass, played once again here by Samuel Jackson. It turns out that a psychiatrist named Dr. Staple, played by Sarah Paulson, has been recruited to help the three of them and convince each of them that they are actually not superheroes with amazing powers or any gifts, though, of course, we, the audience, have already seen the evidence that they do possess special powers in the previous films. So we spend a good chunk of time engaged in dialogue and like a support group of sorts surrounding these three individuals as they begin to question their identity. And Dr. Staple also wants to conduct an experimental procedure to help Mr. Glass's brain become more malleable, we'll say. But Mr. Glass has other plans, particularly for Kevin, who's one of many personalities is known as the Beast, who can crush dudes with a single embrace and sort of leap around like a cheetah, possessing incredible strength and agility. So Mr. Glass decides it's time to break free along with Kevin, while the unbreakable David also may end up playing a significant role in how all of this plays out, with sort of a final act showdown that takes place before the eyes of many, including Glass's mother, David's son, and Casey also returns here, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who successfully stopped the Beast in Split and kind of has the power to keep Kevin out of trouble. So obviously something interesting must play out with these very different three characters, particularly during the final stretch, as we would hope, since this is essentially the conclusion of M. Night's story, and he usually has tricks up his sleeve. Whether they're successful or not, that's kind of always up for debate. So, for me, I don't know. I'm not completely down on M. Night to the same degree that you two have been in the past. I think it's just a matter of appreciating certain elements or performances or scores or cinematography. I think the majority of his filmography is unsuccessful, especially when it comes down to the third acts. I just think where he tends to fail fundamentally really is with the scripts.
there's just really a lot of eye-rolling dialogue in the majority of his films, ridiculous character choices that don't seem to fit, and just a lot of odd decisions. And I think a lot of that is sort of captured and summarized in one of the worst films I've ever seen, which to me was The Happening. And, you know, that being said, though, I was very surprised by Split. I actually quite liked it. I mean, it has, you know, your expected scenery chewing performance at the center, but I also really liked the message at the end of the film about shared trauma and sort of feeling connected to someone who's been through a lot and finding comfort in it. It was a nice message to end that film on, and I actually walked out feeling like, I think I really liked an M. Night movie for once. But then, of course, that final moment that sort of let us know that, hey, this is essentially a sequel to Unbreakable, definitely made my eyes roll. So now with Glass, I got to say, it did very little for me. We spend such a long stretch of this film kind of imprisoned inside his really, really lazy, lackluster writing and the hammering of the superhero themes and mythology that's always spoken front and center in this sort of like really insulting, pandering degree most of the time. It really feels more like fan fiction from its own creator rather than anything that sort of functions and flows organically. And it's really a dull film. I mean, I think both Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson kind of sleepwalk through their performances and bring very little here. I mean, Sarah Paulson and McAvoy do their best with very little, and of course, without giving anything away. I just think the layering of twists in the third act is, again, eye-rolling and simplistic and silly. I just think M. Night often thinks he's being really profound and enlightening when it's actually really uninteresting and not deep in any way, shape, or form. So, I mean, I think he thinks there's a lot to be said here about, you know, belief and self-empowerment or whatever, but none of it really rings true or just sticks the landing, especially as things play out. So as much as I did like Split and kind of liked Unbreakable, I got to say that Glass is M. Night at his laziest and displaying everything that I kind of find bad about his work. So this is really a boring, empty experience that I cannot recommend to anyone.
All right. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress and Jim Liskowski here. We are reviewing Glass, M. Night Shyamalan's follow-up to Unbreakable and Split. And we'll get Eric's thoughts and my thoughts and box office, too, as we continue. We'll take a break right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And we've got my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk with Rod Pyle, our space guy, about the Blood Moon and much, much more. We're also going to talk Star Trek movies and then tell you how you can celebrate MLK Day. So all of that and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. We're in the middle of the movie reviews here before the break. Jim Liskowski told us about Glass. And he is not recommending it. And let's get the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Eric. what did you think of Glass?
Oh, Nick. You and I have been talking movies for 20 years now.
Yep.
On your show.
Yep.
And in that time, M. Night Shyamalan has never made a good movie. In my opinion.
Yeah.
So people who want to listen to this review with a grain of salt and a drink of water, that's their business.
Let me just say this before you get into it. I never liked a movie of his until Split.
But you don't like the movie as much as you like McAvoy.
Right. No, exactly. And I hate the last scene. I mean, I just the last scene of Split, I just went, you got to be kidding me, right?
Right.
The reason why I like Split is simply because of McAvoy. I think McAvoy's good in this too. He's one of my favorite actors on the planet, and I really thought he tore it up in Split. So that's the reason why.
Well, McAvoy shows up to work.
Yes, he does.
And he showed up in Split, and he shows up in Glass, which is more than I can say for Bruce Willis. So I'll get to in a second.
Yeah.
I am just, you know, watching, you know, Jim was, you know, describing a lot of the twists and turns in this movie as silly and, you know, pedantic and whatever. I find them rather insulting. And the reason being because, you know, M. Night has his fans. I don't dispute that. You know, I know there's Team Villages out there, okay? I know they exist.
Yeah.
Okay? And so, granted, most everyone seems to agree that Unbreakable may just be his best movie. Okay, so I will grant them that. Like, you know, it's the least bad of... that and Signs, I think, are the least bad of his movies. So the prospect of someone who is really a fan of Unbreakable might react differently to that final scene of Split. And if I cared, I would think that that was really cool.
Yeah.
Like, oh, man, we're finally, this is finally happening. Okay, no pun intended.
Yeah.
And so here comes Glass, and he's going to complete this trilogy that he said he was going to give the fans back in 2000, and here we're going to wrap this whole thing up. And the entire exercise to me, and I do mean exercise because it's not a film, the entire exercise to me feels like someone you encounter on Twitter, okay, or someone in a coffee shop who tells you you are a moron for liking comic books. You are an absolute moron. You have wasted your life liking comic books. Okay, but I got this really cool idea for a comic book. You should listen to what I got to say. Okay? And when he lays out the climax of the film, which I'm obviously not going to give away.
Yeah.
But when he lays out his first, the first of which is his signature twist to the thing. If I was deeply invested in this world, I would want to strangle him for what he does in the third act of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be like, you have got to be kidding me. Okay? And then he follows it up with a denouement that is just idiotic. Because in 2000, when Unbreakable came out and he was starting to create this world, the world had not even gotten Sam Raimi's Spider-Man yet.
Right.
We were not on the precipice of the Marvel Cinematic Universe or even the DC Universe.
Right.
Okay? But now, 19 years later, we are neck deep in all of this stuff. Comic book films are the thing. Except the world that he continues to inhabit is a world where there's no comic book movies, apparently. You couldn't even think to mention any of those. The only thing that exists is the Batman TV show, apparently, and comic book places are apparently like speakeasies. Every comic book shop that they frequent in the film is like some backdoor place, and, you know, Anya Taylor-Joy goes in there, and there's like, oh my god, a girl comes in here. You know, it's that level of just insult to people who are true comic book fans, people who look upon the stuff as art, okay? Yes, we've been inundated with comic book films, and yes, we wish that there was a lot more out there, but there are some really good ones. And watching him, you know, go through the motions and lay out, trying to, you know, hypnotize us in a way, or beating us over the head and telling us, you're wrong for liking these movies, the way that Sarah Paulson does, and what I think is the worst scene in the entire film, this extended therapy session where she tries to reason with them and say, like, well, maybe if, you know, what really happened is you did this. It's some of the worst writing M. Night has ever done, frankly.
Yeah.
And it upset me even more because I don't think Sarah Paulson has ever been worse in anything she's ever done. She looks I know that part of that's ingrained in the character and what that character is, but she looks confused. She looks like she's like a hostage as she looks at the screen. She's actually looks like she's looking at the audience going, help me get out of this. I am being held here against my will, saying these ridiculous lines. That is like the opposite of the end of Contact, where they try to convince Jodie Foster that everything that she has seen is not what she has really seen.
Right.
It is awful in so many ways, insulting in ways that, and I'm not even a comic book reader myself, but I felt insulted. I felt insulted on behalf of all of his fans. I'm like, how could you do that to the people who still support you? You know, I was like, screw you, frankly, on behalf of the people who have supported you through Lady in the Water and The Happening and After Earth, and like, oh, you're not that bad, you know, shame on you, M. Night Shyamalan, shame on you.
Yeah, this is terrible. I mean, this is really terrible. I happen to like Split and until the final scene, and then I was like, oh, come on. And then this whole, I mean, I didn't like Unbreakable. I know a lot of people maintain that that's probably his best movie, and I know a lot of people like that movie. They really do. And the thing is that you're absolutely right about this being insulting, Eric, completely, because the people that like Unbreakable are comic book fans. They're, you know what I mean? They're genuine
yeah.
comic book fans. Everybody I know who likes Unbreakable is a comic book fan, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it's an insult to the people who liked Unbreakable. You know, and I know that a lot of fans of Unbreakable were very excited at the last scene of Split. You know what I mean? People were like, oh, awesome. You know, they were very, because I, you know, I know a lot of people who like Unbreakable, and they were very excited that final scene. But man, this is just, I mean, this is as bad as it gets. It's one of the worst movies he's ever made, and he's made a lot of terrible movies, and it's long and it's boring. And why did Bruce Willis even show up? You want to talk about sleepwalking through a role. You know what I mean? I mean, it was just the laziest acting I've ever seen. And Samuel Jackson's just doing the Samuel Jackson thing, and he doesn't seem very invested in it. The only person who showed up to play again is McAvoy, and he, you know, he's got, yeah, I mean, the script is ridiculous, but he does, you know, what he can. You can tell he's having a lot of fun doing all these, you know, different characters and all that stuff. So he's fun to watch. You know, bringing back some of the characters from Unbreakable doesn't make any sense, and especially doesn't make any sense to bring Anya Taylor-Joy back to this movie. That just seems completely
also seemed further insulting the way that they were trying to make you sympathize with the McAvoy character who mutilates young girls. Let's not beat around the bush.
Yeah,
he mutilates young girls, and they were trying to do this whole Beauty and the Beast thing with him.
Right.
Which, I mean, you know, they actually calls him the Beast, and they're trying to do a Beauty and the Beast. You're really on top of it, Knight.
Yeah. and it's, I mean, there's nothing exciting about this. I mean, the only thing that's kind of fun to watch is McAvoy, you know, because he's so good. But man, this is as base and stupid as it gets, and with a really insulting message. You're right, but the overall thing is, though, guys, this movie's boring. It's just just really boring. Like, nothing. There are stretches where nothing happens, and you're like, what are we doing here? I mean, it's not
to mention that your title character doesn't speak for 66 minutes.
Right.
Okay? Your title character doesn't speak for 66 minutes, and again, like, I know that you can't help but sometimes in the trailer, but the guy's either doped up or he's not for 66 minutes.
Right.
What do you think the answer is?
Yeah, yeah. And
that's not the twist.
It's 2 hours and 10 minutes long, too. So it's not it's not a short movie by any stretch of the imagination. And it feels like 2 hours and 10 minutes. And Bruce Willis, I mean, it's the laziest. I mean, I'm glad the check clears. You know what I mean? I mean, my God.
Yeah.
It's like he just doesn't even want to be there. When was the last time Bruce Willis actually gave a good performance?
I mean, Sin City?
Sin City, yeah, I guess Sin City. That would be...
I'm taking a stab at it, because he's done a lot of direct-to-video work.
Yeah, he has.
Over the years, and wow, is he sleepwalking. I mean, he was sleepwalking through his own roast, for God's sake.
It's true. I mean, like, he just doesn't care. You know what I mean? And you can when you're watching this movie, it's like, dude, at least, you know, put some energy into it. I mean, at least. I mean, don't make it so obvious that you clearly don't want to be there. And yes, Eric, Sarah Paulson is so bad in this movie, and she's one of my favorite actresses on the planet.
I know.
and it's she's saddled with some of the most ridiculous dialogue. And that scene that you're talking about, that extended scene, those therapy thing, is just as ridiculous as you could possibly imagine. And she is, yes, you're right. I mean, she's stuck looking directly into the lens of the camera and having to say some of the stupidest dialogue that any actress could ever possibly imagine.
And also, as she walks through this giant mental institution, okay, this giant thing that apparently only employs two orderlies.
Yeah.
By the way,
yeah.
Every time she goes into one of their rooms, she explains everything that's going on in the hospital.
Yeah.
So in case they have any ideas about how to escape or what they need to do, she lays it all out for them in exposition. They're like, wait, why are you telling the patients this?
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It is absolutely ridiculous. And hey, here's a question. I mean, I've only seen Split the one time. You know, I saw it when it came out a couple years ago. Did Betty Buckley get killed in that movie?
Was she the psychiatrist?
Yeah. She does. Because I was going to say,
I believe so.
Because I don't remember, and I was like, well, why don't they have her back? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. She died. Yeah, Patricia or someone killed her.
Somebody kills her, right?
One of his personalities kills her.
Okay. All right. So she does end up getting killed. Because that was when I was watching this movie, I'm like, I don't remember. Because I, you know, the only thing that stayed with me after I saw Split was McAvoy. I don't remember anything. I don't really remember anything else about the movie. I just didn't remember whether, you know, Betty Buckley died or not. But apparently she did, because otherwise they would have and should have brought her back.
Right.
So anyway.
And Robin Wright said, no, thank you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's a really, really terrible movie. It's worse than I thought it was going to be, and I thought it was going to be awful. And you remember that time where it was embarrassing to have M. Night Shyamalan's name on stuff, and he wasn't putting his name above the titles or anything? Remember those days?
Yeah, I remember, the Devil trailer.
Yeah, I miss those days.
Yeah. Although I think they're going to come back with a vengeance,
Yeah,
Nick.
You think so?
I think that this is the movie where where everyone turns on him again.
Yeah. I really do.
I think this is his next village moment.
Yeah, and I will tell you this. You know, judging from, you know, social media and my Facebook page and stuff like that, people hate this movie. People are hating.
They do.
I mean, the people are hating it. We're not the only three. You know what I mean?
Like, nope.
Even the fans.
No, the fans are hating it.
Yeah, the fans are hating it. Like the Unbreakable fans are hating it. So, all right.
They totally should. And I've given him a pass here and there in the past, but. This is like up there with The Happening in terms of how bad it is.
And we'll talk about the box office, and we'll see how much it drops. There's no competition for it next week, right? Oh, well, wait.
I'm pretty much no competition over the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. I'm actually looking forward to The Kid Who Would Be King, but that's not the same audience. You know what I mean?
Absolutely not.
But I'm actually looking forward to that movie. I think that movie looks really, really fun. And it's the guy who directed Attack of the Block.
Right,
so,
first movie since then, and what I hear, a lot of good things.
Yeah, no, it looks terrific. It's a great. I mean, listen. First of all, you got you got Patrick Stewart, right? It's Patrick Stewart, right? Is in it. He plays.
Is he in it?
One of those guys.
he's in it.
Yeah, it's Patrick Stewart. He plays Merlin. He plays like the older version of Merlin who disguises himself as a teenager. And you got Patrick Stewart with a Zeppelin shirt on. So I'm like, okay. Patrick Stewart's wearing a Led Zeppelin shirt. I'm all over this.
So, uh-huh.
But what about Serenity? Now, this is a movie with Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey that they're just, it seems like, is this a movie that's been on the schedule for a long time? It seems like it's being dumped.
Yeah, it was supposed to come out last October, and they just pushed it into January. I don't think that they know how to market the film. Because if you look at the trailer, it's like some people describe it as like a film noir kind of thing. It looks like, you know, like this year's Palmetto. But other people, the title of it suggests that, you know, it might be something, you know, ethereal or something, that it's, you know, one of those types of movies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've seen the trailer for it, and Anne Hathaway has done the circuit promoting it. And it looks just like, hey, I want to hire you to kill somebody. I want you to throw my husband off of the boat. That's all I can figure out. So anyway, well, we'll
but
talk about that.
It's written by Stephen Knight, and he did Dirty Pretty Things and wrote the script for Eastern Promises, but he also directed a really good Tom Hardy movie, Locke.
Yeah, Yeah. All right. Well, we'll find out next week. All right. Jim, thanks, buddy, and we'll talk to you next week.
Absolutely. It's always a blast, man.
You
catch you then.
Okay, take care. There's Jim. He's going to – and Eric, you hang on, okay?
Yeah.
All right, Eric's going to hang on. When we come back, we're going to talk box office for the week right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Coming up after the 2:30 news, our good friend Rod Pyle is going to join us to talk all things space, and also he's got some great stuff about the crazy blood moon that's out there, and we'll talk about that and more. We're going to talk Star Trek movies, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Eric Childress is hanging out with me to talk box office, and let's get Eric back here. Hey, Eric.
Hey.
All right. So these are just the 3-day totals because they're doing, they're counting the 4-day total because today is a holiday. So
right. They would, right.
So, but these are just for the weekend, not the, mm-hmm. Just for the 3 days. Number one, Glass with $40.5 million. Weren't people predicting over 50 for this?
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is a really low number.
Yeah,
actually, I mean it's big for January.
Yeah,
it's very big for January. But depending on what the movie does, I mean, I think everyone, including myself, had figured that this movie was going to have the second best Martin Luther King weekend ever. Mm-hmm. American Sniper being number one, and it should have been very easily. The second best, but there's a chance it might not beat the first ride along film.
Wow.
Which would be really kind of stunning, actually. And that leaves the door open to see exactly where this film is going to go from here. Like we had just kind of mentioned, there's not a lot of competition over the next couple of weeks. We
right.
got the Kid Who Would Be King and Serenity next week, and then the remake of Miss Bala comes out the week after that.
Right.
Which, and that's the only thing opening that week, so they're not expecting a lot of money out of that. Unless The Kid Who Would Be King finds some kind of audience, I think that's the only thing that could take it down over the next couple of weeks until, like, the 8th when, like, the Lego movie and a whole bunch of stuff opens on February 8th.
Yeah.
But I'm really very curious to see how the numbers go, like, where the numbers drop from, because I mean, it's got to drop 50%.
Oh, it's going to drop
than that
yeah. oh,
next
yeah.
week.
No, it's going to drop so, big. Yeah.
Yeah. So this thing's got to be in the teens probably next weekend. Probably might still be number one. Unless Kid Who Would Be King. That'd be hilarious if Kid Who Would Be King beats
yeah,
it. That'd be
yeah.
wonderful.
It would.
That'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'm really not going to rule it out just yet. It'd be shocking if this thing didn't make $100 million. I mean, the Martin Luther King holiday is going to help that immensely.
Yeah.
But I think that you're going to look at probably something under 125.
That's amazing.
Which is less than what Split made.
Yeah.
And but it's all kind of semantics because this film is already practically in profit already.
Yeah.
It only cost $20 million. Blumhouse is, knows exactly how to rein Shyamalan in.
Right.
They give him a big building, but you only have two orderlies.
Right.
So I mean, $40 million this weekend on a $20 million budget, it's just about there.
Yeah. All right. Number two is The Upside, $15.6 million. Solid numbers.
The very solid numbers.
Yeah,
this is actually a real surprise hit.
Yeah.
This is a much as big a story as Glass, as far as I'm concerned, because this is looking like something that's going to exceed $70 million. I know the Sunday to Monday is a holiday, but I made $19.5 million last week and 15.6 this weekend. That's
yeah.
an incredibly small drop.
So this
thing is it's clearly playing well with adults, and like Glass, it's got 2 weeks of not a lot of competition.
Right.
The Serenity's not going to make dime one.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
And I don't think Ms. Ball is going to do particularly well either.
Yeah. Number three, Dragon Ball Super Broly. We talked about that one already. Big success. Number four, Aquaman. It's over $300 million in America.
In the top 25 worldwide all time.
And then number five is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Big success for that one, man, because it was again another movie that came out of nowhere.
Yeah, holding very well. $160 million at this point. $200 million, might, you know, seems a little bit out of its reach, but. Right. Animated Spider-Man doing this well, and is going to be, again, this is one of those movies that's going to linger and last for a while.
I agree. All right, Eric, have a safe trip, and we'll talk to you from Sundance, okay, buddy?
Sounds great. Thanks
very
much.
We'll have Eric back. He'll be live from Sundance with a couple of reports next week. He leaves on Thursday for the Sundance Film Festival, and he'll give us exclusive reports of some of the new movies that he's going to see while he's there. All right, we're going to take a break here on 720 WGN. The news is next. All right. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. And, yeah, we're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive for this Monday morning. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We are going to talk about, we're going to rank the Star Trek movies, all of them. Talk a little bit about that and more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. 312-981-7200. If you have any space-related questions and you would like to have them answered, our good friend Rod Pyle is joining us this morning. So if you want to jump in with a space-related question, talk or text at 312-981-7200. Award-winning author, filmmaker, speaker on space. His latest books, Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration, and Space 2.0, are available for pre-order now. You can check out pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com, for more information. And let's welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, welcome back.
Good morning, Nick. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. A little tired, but I bet I'm not as tired as you.
Yeah. No, I'm okay. I'm good. And, you know, we wanted to have you on to talk about the super blood wolf moon, as they're calling it. Super blood wolf moon is they're calling it. Now, we were not able to see, at least here in Chicago, I was not able to see it. We had snow and clouds all over the place, so I have not been able to take a look at it. Yeah, tell us all about the Super Blood Wolf Moon.
So first, let's break down this name, which the press has just been having a field day with.
Okay.
So the blood part has to do with, I mean, all lunar eclipses are red, because the solar eclipse, the moon passes between the sun and the earth, and it blocks out the sun. The lunar eclipse, the opposite, the moon passes behind the earth, goes into shadow. It's much longer. You know, totality lasts for an hour, that red phase. So because it's dipping into the shadow behind the Earth, the longer red wavelengths of light are the ones that don't get scattered by the atmosphere, and they get bent around the Earth, and so they bathe the moon in this red light. Because the moon is a little closer on this eclipse, it went a little deeper into that shadow and made for this kind of darker gray-red, which is where you get the blood part from. Wolf moon is just the first full moon in January, so that's not that big a deal.
Okay.
So, yeah, so it didn't sound, it's not quite as exciting as it sounds. You know, it didn't get us all out in our front yards howling and undressing in the cold or anything. So, yeah, it was cool. I didn't have a chance to see much of it because I was doing this webcast with this group called Astronomers Without Borders, and I think Nat Geo picked it up. But I did get out there and get a few looks at it, and we had cloud problems here too. But it's pretty spectacular. You know, all lunar eclipses are neat. They're very relaxed. In the right conditions, if you're not Chicago or the summer, you can go out and set up a lawn chair and just kind of enjoy it for as long as it takes. So it goes into gray part first, and then red, and then gray again, and then exits. So it was a lot of fun to see, and I hope you get to see the next one. There was somebody live streaming on Facebook from Chicago who had a pretty clear shot, so you must have just had regional clouds there, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we did, because it was last night when the first chance that I had to see it, we got snow coming out of the sky and everything, so there were clouds everywhere, and I didn't get a chance to see it. how often does this happen?
Well, lunar eclipses happen, I guess, about every year and a half at least, but this one was weird because the supermoon part is about 20,000 miles closer to Earth, which is almost a tenth of its distance, if you think about it, 240,000 miles. So something that big won't happen again. I think this full combination is another press item. You know, it'll be 10 years before it happens again, but there'll be another good lunar eclipse in about three, so they're not that rare. Solar eclipses are the tough ones, and we talked about that before. You know, if you ever get a chance to drop everything and go run and see a solar eclipse, that's truly a life-altering event. Lunar eclipses are kind of a year altering event, I guess.
And according to this, it says for the Chicago area, this will be the last visible total eclipse until May 15th, 2022.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's about 3 years, right?
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah.
Yeah, so you'll have another chance. You'll still be around.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, who names these? How did Wolf Moon become the first full moon in January? Why is it a wolf moon?
The wolf moon part, like I said, the wolf moon just means first full moon in January. I think this goes back to the days of Poor Richard's Almanac and that kind of thing, probably earlier than that. But it's like, Anglo culture back into the probably 14th, 15th century or something. And these things just come along. I don't know if it has any Native American roots or not. I think this is all European. But I didn't really look into it that deeply. I just wanted to figure out what the heck each of those terms meant, because they seem to get longer every year.
Yeah.
You know, next one's going to be Super Blood Wolf Howling Disco of the 80s Hairband Moon or something. And we're going to have to sit there and pick that one apart, and that's going to be a real drill.
Yeah. Well, so the Super Blood Wolf Moon, and I will say this, on my news feed, at least in the social media, a lot of people posted pictures. A lot of people were taking a look at it. There were moon pictures all over my news feed.
Well, and it used to be, if you had a telescope, you had to lug your telescope out, and then you had to get out your SLR camera and an adapter. And if you wanted to take, not for the moon, but for deep space pictures, you'd chill the film down and all this kind of stuff. Now there are adapters, so you can just hook your iPhone up to a smaller telescope and get a perfectly decent picture. You saw a lot of pictures probably of big red fuzzy balls because an iPhone was just, or the smartphone was maxed out on its telephoto and tried desperately to focus on something. So those weren't so great. They're pretty grainy and nasty. But if you get even just a basic telescope, because the moon's so close and so large and so bright, you can shoot it with almost anything. So it's really fun to go out and get those pictures. I actually tried with a pair of binoculars, but I didn't have enough hands, so that didn't work out.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, there it is. The Super Blood Wolf Moon. A little information about that. But by the way, tell everybody, Rod, about yourself. Give you a little background on Rod Pyle.
I'm one of those guys that grew up in the space age. I'm 62 now, so I was just the right age to really enjoy all that stuff. So I kind of became aware of this during Gemini and then certainly during the Apollo years. And that was just the greatest adventure I'd ever seen. So while the other kids were grooving on sports, I was staying home from school watching moonwalks as much as you could before the networks broke in. Unbelievably to me, with reruns of I Love Lucy and General Hospital, I just thought that was a crime.
Yeah.
And then, we went in the Skylab era and the shuttle era. That was all still really engaging, but I got off in other pursuits. But then in 2005, I had a chance to write a book about the Apollo program, which I just heard, the publisher didn't tell me, but I just heard that's being reissued too. So everything I've ever written that had anything to do with the moon is coming out again in 2019, yeah. With or without my help, apparently. And it just became this real treasure, because I'd made TV documentaries, but you have to tell the whole history of the space race in 44 minutes, and it's kind of like writing TV guide blurbs or tweets or something.
Yeah.
So the fact that you can get into a book and really just kind of roll around and soak it all up and have fun with it is great, and it's, like I've said many times to you, it's got to be almost as much fun as radio.
Yeah, not quite. Not quite.
Nothing's as much fun as radio.
So, Rod, speaking of the moon, China, they wanted to grow some plants on the moon. Tell me a little bit about what's going on there.
So this is the Chang'e 4, or Chang'e, if you pronounce it the Chinese way, 4 lander that landed on the far side of the moon, not the dark side. It goes through phases just like the near side. But because one side of the moon always faces this, it's what's called tidally locked. There apparently is a mass offset of some kind that causes it to be gravitationally attracted to the Earth on the front side. The back side is very different, much more cratered, much more beat up, completely unexplored except from orbit, people shooting photos. So China had kind of been pacing the space race years of the 60s and doing what we in the Soviet Union had done back then at a slower pace. So it's about 2003. And then this is the first real deviation from that path. This is something new. We looked at it. I think the Soviets looked at it back in the 60s. I'm trying to put something on the far side. In fact, one of the Apollo missions is even considered to go to the far side. But one of the big problems is, besides the fact that we don't know that much about it, is that the moon blocks all radio transmissions. So you have to put a satellite up in a stationary orbit beyond the moon to relay these signals. So they did that successfully, and then the lander, the spacecraft went into orbit in mid-December, and then the lander came down in January 1st, Beijing time. And it's a stationary lander and a rover. And then they had solicited a bunch of experiments from universities around the country, and one of them was, let's put a bunch of plants and some insects in this pressurized canister and put it up there and see what happens. So what you're looking for is reactions to temperature and lunar environment, which are pretty predictable. It gets really cold, down to about minus 250, so things are going to die. But they want to see how plants that might be possible agricultural crops for a future lunar colony would do, particularly because the radiation out there is vicious. It's on the order of 600 times what you get underneath the Earth's protective magnetosphere and atmosphere. So that was a big part of it. What's puzzling, and all the Western press accounts I've read about this have said the same thing, that they're presuming that the experiment was designed to end after a few weeks when lunar night came to that side of the moon, which lasts for 2 weeks because the temperatures would plunge. But what puzzles me about that is they had fruit flies up there as part of that experiment. And fruit flies are very promiscuous, and they reproduce quickly, so you can study mutations and so forth, but not in that short a period of time. So I'm really wondering if there were heaters along for the ride that didn't, for some reason, switch on or function, and that's why, because it went down to minus 62 degrees and everything died. And that's all they've said. So I think this may be one of those kind of limited news release things, but it's still exciting that they did it. And hopefully that probe, so far they haven't had the kind of luck that JPL has in engineering with these things lasting a long time. I think the first rover lasted about 3 weeks or a month. But they're getting better at it, and we should be getting results from this for a good long while. And part of what they're looking at, the next mission, which is supposed to happen later this year, Chang'e 5, will bring back lunar samples. So they'll be the third country to do that after us and the Soviet Union. And then after that, they want to build up kind of a robotic base down near the South Lunar Pole and have an assembly of machines so they can do long-term exploration planning for this human mission that they want to do in the late 2020s.
Oh, all right. Okay. Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, a few more stories here that Rod's going to talk about, and he is a space expert. His latest books are Interplanetary Robots and Space 2.0. You can check out pilebooks.com for more information. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. More with Rod right after we break here on 720 WGN. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell at 5. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Our good friend Rod Pyle is with us, an award-winning author and an expert on space. And he's here to talk about some of the latest space stories. And we were talking about the Super Blood Wolf Moon a little earlier. Let's welcome Rod back. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk about this artificial meteor shower. What do we got going here?
This is a really cool story. So on I think it was Sunday night, Japan launched a rocket. They have a slightly smaller fleet than ours, but a number of very capable rockets. They launched a rocket carrying a big science and engineering satellite. And the primary mission was for that satellite to test all these new spaceflight technologies that they've been developing. So advanced propulsion and better solar panels and a new star tracker for navigating in space and things like that. But it also carried these six little CubeSats. This is becoming much more common now that these larger boosters will carry a primary payload and then a bunch of secondary ones. So I think the record was held by India. It launched 101 CubeSats out of one rocket. So these six CubeSats, they're about the size of a shoebox, a little smaller, contain a bunch of pellets, and they won't tell us what the pellets are made of, but some proprietary mix that they guarantee us is non-toxic, not that it really matters at that altitude. And they're like shotgun shells. So these things, it will be timed out so that they'll dip lower in their orbits. They have little parachutes, so there's just enough drag up there to bring them down to a lower orbit. And then a door pops open, and these pellets get popped out, and there's dozens of them, and they're only about a third of an inch in diameter. But the average shooting star you see is about the size of a large grain of sand, certainly smaller than a pea. So they're going to create this spectacular man-made meteor shower, and they can time it to be over a certain region and do it pretty much whenever they want within about 40 minutes either way, given the mechanics of the orbit. So this is an entertainment company. and this is going to be their, they have some science goals, but their main reason for being is to create these special entertainment events, which should be pretty spectacular.
That's pretty cool. And the name of the company is Astro Live Experiences.
Yeah. What's in the name, right?
Yeah.
It's a Japanese company. And I think what kind of compels me about this, I mean, this in itself is really interesting. But, you know, I think as launch costs come down, these private operators begin sending their rockets up more and more frequently and charging less to do so, you're going to see more of these kinds of non-essential, quote-unquote, non-science and engineering missions. Probably you'll start seeing orbital advertising. There's been a lot of dissent about, you know, because you can now get a whole constellation of lit satellites, dozens, even hundreds of them, to fly in formation if you want. But if you do that, now you've got orbiting billboards, and you can see a Pepsi ad up there every night for, you know, the minutes that it takes to go overhead. Most of us don't want to, but that's something that, that may start happening, and you could even someday see something on the moon doing that, and it would probably all be in the good old name of advertising. So that's kind of a weird one. The final part about this is there is some scientific interest because they're able to trigger this, the shower, this meteor shower on demand. They're able to track the trajectory of the pellets and see exactly what angle they enter the atmosphere and so forth and how long it takes them to burn and all that, what temperatures they are. So it gives them kind of a control base to be able to get more data about how that whole thing works.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
It's neat.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, you know, and the technology. Now, how often are they going to do this?
They haven't said. I think they've got another flight scheduled to go up later in the year. But and I don't know if they're going to release all six of these at once for this first one or if they're staged in some way. They had announced the time. It would be visible over Japan only, of course, a little further than that. So that part I don't know. But I think if this works and if people get interested and if the costs are low enough, you'll be able to see this happening more and more often. Because imagine your corporate retreat. It's like, okay, everybody step outside. It's a nice summer night. And God's fireworks are going to start in the sky at about 5 minutes. I mean, that's a pretty cool deal.
That is cool. That's very, very cool. Is anybody, you know, in America working on this kind of technology?
I know there's people working on these kinds of programs in general terms. I hadn't heard anybody doing anything about, you know, bespoke meteor showers. But I know, like I said, there's the talk about various forms of orbital advertising and so forth. So there are certainly companies doing this. The question is how many of them will come to fruition. You know, Japan is an interesting country. If you spend any time there, it's like the whole thing about fembots. You know, why are all fembots 25-year-old Japanese females? It's just what they do. So they kind of focus on these cool and unusual and unique things, and I guess this is going to be one of them. So this is where it seems to have popped up first, and hopefully will be next because it's kind of fun.
Yeah, that's very cool. Hey, I got a couple of texts here, Rod.
Okay.
Dave in Monroe, Wisconsin, simply asks, when will man land on Mars?
That's a really good question. If you listen to Elon Musk sometime around 2024 to 2026, we all think that's pretty ambitious and optimistic. If you listen to NASA sometime in the mid to late 2030s, if you listen to China sometime in the early 2040s, you know, there's a lot of problems with that. One is how long it takes to get there, and you got to protect people all the way out there from radiation and other mishaps that can happen from the technology. So we've been talking about it for decades, but the more we find out about the space between planets and the environment on Mars, the further the goal seems to get away because it's just a really hostile place. Mm. There's a lot of radiation out there. There are a lot of other obstacles, and then the Martian surface itself is pretty nasty. Even the soil is toxic. So they got to work all that stuff out before you can just get up there and step on it. And finally, there's the concern about contamination. We're concerned about bringing back some kind of monsters from the planet, probably in the form of microbes that can do damage to us.
Yeah.
But more recently, there's been concern about what Earth microbes will do once they're on the Martian surface. And everybody carries them, no matter how much you try and clean things. So there's a movement of trying to keep Mars pure, and we're going to have to figure out how we're going to deal with that.
Mm, okay. Lots of variables there, for sure.
Yes.
218 area code says, do you ever think we'll figure out a way for us as a species to leave our solar system, or do you think that that kind of space travel is just not possible and we're stuck here?
I was just writing about that. You know, there's so many interesting things happening there. They're not being developed right now, but there's a lot of discussion about it and forward-looking ideas about technology that could be developed. So you've either got to have a generational shift where people procreate and breed, and it takes tens or hundreds of years to get there, depending on what kind of propulsion system you're using, or you got to put people into deep sleep, or you just send a bunch of DNA up there and then sort of respawn the human race on the other end, which would probably be one of the closer star systems like Alpha Centauri, because that's only quote-unquote 4 light-years away, which is many trillions of miles. Or one of the ones I find the most compelling is this kind of transhumanism argument, where you take human consciousness and you put it in some kind of machine, little mechanical cockroach is my favorite, because they're light, they're small, they're indestructible, and now you can go exploring anywhere. You're just not very good-looking while you're doing it, and you're still getting the data back and kind of having this sort of virtual existence out there. So it's a huge conversation. I cover a little bit of it in the Space 2.0 book, but it's something that really deserves a book of its own, and I know that people like Michio Kaku have written about it. So that's the big, broad, sweeping answer.
Okay. All right. So your books, really quickly, tell us about Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of the Space Exploration.
So that book is really, it's kind of JPL-centric, but it's also got a lot of stories in the Soviet Union. So it's kind of looking at the space, sort of a sequel to my Amazing Stories of Space Age book, which is about human spaceflight. This is the machine side. So all the way from the very first launch of Sputnik up through the end of the Cassini mission, I just wanted to look at all the amazing robotic programs they had had and a bunch of them that were designed that didn't fly. For instance, there was an early idea about sending this life science laboratory up to Mars in the early 1960s, which was also called Voyager. That name was then recycled for the Outer Planets mission. And it was so big it would have to be launched on a Saturn V, so it was kind of like taking your Winnebago up to Mars to look for life. So that one obviously didn't fly.
Right.
So that's the gist of it.
All right. And then the other one that you just mentioned, Space 2.0.
That was a longer effort. I interviewed about 40 people from various governments and U.S. government agencies and private spaceflight companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic and so forth to really just try and get a grasp on what we're looking at over the next 20 years. So it's a look at both the international programs, domestic government programs, foreign government programs, and the private sector, and try to find out where the sweet spot is between all these different endeavors. You know, how do you blend them in such a way that you can get out there quickly and effectively and affordably and build some kind of infrastructure so you start really mining the riches of the solar system, which is substantial, and begin seeing a financial return, and then ultimately try to settle space with human beings.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Rod, always a pleasure to have you on, man. Thank you for all the insight, and thank you for giving us a little bit background information on the Super Blood Wolf Moon.
So. Okay.
All right. Rod, hey, by the way, Rod, do you have a favorite Star Trek movie?
I think Star Trek 2, hands down. You know, they always say the odd ones are the best. I enjoyed 1. I'm not sure anybody else did.
Yeah.
4 was fun, but it wasn't really a Star Trek movie, I guess, not the way we think of it. The new ones, I got real mixed feelings about them. What
yeah.
do you think?
Well, we're going to dive into that after the news. We're going to talk about the Star Trek movies. Nerdist ranked them from best to worst. So we're going to
I'll bring up your feed.
Okay. Thanks, Rod.
Thanks.
Always a pleasure, buddy. Rod Pyle, everybody. Check out pilebooks.com. News is up next. Oh, yeah. Hey. Good morning, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And, yeah, so we would like to hear from you guys. We love talking sci-fi when, you know, Rod Pyle's a great guy. He worked on sci-fi TV shows and movies and stuff. And as well as being an expert on space, but I thought it would be kind of fun to talk some sci-fi and specifically Star Trek. I want to get to you guys and I want to hear from you guys about Star Trek. We've got all the movies, including the you know, the reboots with that J.J. Abrams put together. There are 13 Star Trek films, and Nerdist, a guy named Eric Diaz from Nerdist, ranked them in order from. Worst to best. And where do you guys stand on some of these things? 312-981-7200. We would love to hear from you. 312-981-7200, and we'll go through each of the Star Trek movies and talk about them and rank them. Now, Dan, you've never seen the original cast or the Next Generation movies.
Correct.
But you have seen the J.J. Abrams. Have you seen all the J.J.
Abrams? No, just the first one, and I think bits and pieces of the second one.
Okay. So you saw the original Star Trek, which that J.J. Abrams made, that was 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did Into Darkness,
right,
which was 2013, and then Beyond, which was 2016. So I remember the first time I saw the trailer for Star Trek Beyond, and they used Sabotage by the Beastie Boys,
right?
He's in the trailer, and I was just like, "That's really weird, but also awesome." And they do use it in the movie. They play it in the movie, on the ship, like Simon Pegg plays it, and I like Star Trek Beyond. Simon Pegg co-wrote it, and I liked it. I was never a big Star Trek fan. I never watched the TV show. I mean, I've seen it. You know, I've seen it. You can't not have seen at least parts of episodes of Star Trek because it's been around for such a long time, and they're rerun constantly. MeTV is going to start rerunning them again. I think right after Sven. By the way, I was on Sven.
Yeah, I saw your Facebook post.
Yeah, he had a bunch of clips from Flashback this past year at Flashback, and every year I'm honored to introduce Rich. You know, Sven Gulli every year at our Flashback. This is the Flashback Horror Convention, Flashback Weekend. It happens the first weekend in August at the Crown Plaza Hotel, and I've been a host with Flashback since the very beginning, since the very, very first Flashback convention, which was in 2002. If you can believe that, it's been that long. But every year, Rich comes, makes a great appearance. There's always a huge line, you know, for Sven Gulli, man. There's always a huge line. He signs everything that people bring, takes pictures, all kinds of stuff, and he does that for a couple of hours. He'll be sitting at that table, you know, for at least 2 hours signing stuff. And then after that, he takes a little break, and then he always hosts the costume contests that we have at Flashback, which to me, I love Flashback Weekend. It's one of my favorite times of the year, no question about it. I especially loved it last year because my future ex-wife, Dana DiLorenzo, was there, and I had a blast with her. But, you know, it's always a great time. I love it. Lots of really cool celebrities. Like this year, for instance, Robert Englund's coming back. Bruce Campbell is going to be there. Tony Todd, Candyman is going to be there. This is Bruce Campbell's first visit back to Flashback since 2005. So it's been a really long time since Bruce has showed up. And he's always fantastic. Ted Raimi's going to be there. So anyway, it's going to be a lot of fun. But the highlight for me is always watching Rich work the room during the costume party, because it's the costume contest, because it's hilarious. And so they showed a bunch of footage of Rich, you know, making comments about the costumes that were the people coming up on costumes. It's always very entertaining. He's always cracking jokes. And some of the costumes that we see every year at the Flashback convention are ridiculous, and they're awesome. So just to see Rich's reaction and how he handles it. And there are two contests. There's one for children and then one for adults. And this kid who won this year, this past year, his costume, he made it onto Sven Gulli too on TV. He was the thing with two heads. So it was him, and he had Rosie Greer. He had another head attached to him with Rosie Greer's face on it. So he was basically Ray Milland, this kid. And the year before, he was Roddy Piper from They Live, and he had the mullet haircut. He had the outfit on, and he carried a big bucket of bubble gum, because you know Roddy's got that line in They Live. It's like, "I've come here to kick ass and chew bubble gum, and I'm all out of bubble gum." And so that was so this kid won again this year. He's fantastic, and the costume. His dad comes up with the costumes. I talked to his dad. I was like, "This is fantastic." So you know, kid has never seen the thing with two heads. You know what I mean? He just never seen it. But anyway, so anyway, I get to introduce Sven Gulli every year at the at the convention for before the costume contest. It's always one of my favorite things to do. I introduce him, and then I sit right down in the front row and just watch. And just watch Rich go through the whole costume thing. It's the most entertaining part of the entire weekend. But yeah, it was cool. I didn't know that Rich didn't tell me that he was going to show that. I'm sitting in front of my TV, and all of a sudden there's me on TV, and I'm like, hey, that's me. I didn't know that I was going to what. By the way, the movie he showed this past weekend is a really wonderful movie. I love Dracula's Daughter. It's a really great film, and really moody and really wonderful. I haven't seen it in a long time. I hadn't seen Dracula's Daughter in a long time. It was great, and of course, you know, the broadcast itself was fantastic because you know it's Rich. But anyway, it was a nice surprise to see my stupid face on TV. So anyway. So, yeah, Star Trek is going to be following Sven. As far as I know, I think it starts in February. They're going to start showing Star Trek. So Dan, did you ever watch the TV show?
I have not seen any episodes of the original. I may have seen one or two.
Of the Next Generation?
One of the Next Generation, and then
there's the one with Bakula.
I did watch one of the Bakulas. I think
how many because now there's another one now that's on CBS All Access,
right?
I don't even know what it's Star Trek
Discovery. I believe.
Discovery, okay. Because there was you know the Next Generation with Patrick Stewart, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was what was the Babylon 5?
I don't think that was a Star Trek.
Oh, okay.
I think that was a similar concept, obviously, but okay. I don't think it's part.
But
of
it didn't
Star
fall
Trek
into
universe.
The Star Trek. What were? Do we know the other ones?
I'm trying to pull it up here.
Because there was. I mean, obviously the Next Generation with Picard. Everybody really loved that.
Okay, so we've got the Next Generation. Then it was Deep Space Nine.
All right, Deep Space Nine.
And then it was Voyager.
Voyager.
So Voyager was...
Was that Bakula?
No, Voyager was Kate Mulgrew.
Oh, Kate Mulgrew, right.
The first one.
Right.
The first female.
She was the first female captain.
Right.
And then what was the one with Bakula? What was that called?
Let's see here.
Because I know that there were a bunch of them.
Yeah.
There were a bunch of Star Trek offshoots.
The wiki's only listing those five. That's interesting. Oh, okay. There was prequels.
Oh, prequels. Okay.
So Enterprise was that Bakula? That was Bakula.
That's Bakula Enterprise?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. And then Discovery, which is the one on CBS All Access, that is also a prequel.
Yeah. I remember when Feinberg and I talked about it, I didn't know that the Bakula one was a prequel.
Yeah. I believe it's the very first
first crew of the Enterprise
of any of the Federation.
Oh, of the entire Federation,
I believe.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I never watched the show. I never got into it. And then, you know, so my exposure to Star Trek was just, you know, pop cultural knowing it, you know, obviously.
Right. But real quick clarification. So it was the first the Enterprise was the very first one. It followed the adventures before the Federation was created, so it's kind of the same as the ship.
And
right before the Federation founded, and apparently the ship was subsumed into it.
Okay, all right. Well, we're talking Star Trek movies, okay, and we're including the reboot, the J.J. Abrams, and we have 13 movies that we're going to talk about here, and I want to hear from you guys, Star Trek fans out there. What are your favorite or least favorite Star Trek movies? Send your text or call us at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, and we'll jump into the Star Trek universe and rank those movies. This is Eric Diaz wrote this at Nerdist.com. And he put them all in order from worst to best, and that's exactly what we're gonna jump into. And we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on the 18th floor on Wacker, overlooking beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here until... 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. We're talking Star Trek. We're talking Star Trek movies. Eric Diaz from Nerdist.com ranked all 13 of the Star Trek movies from worst to best. And we're going to jump into that. Hey, you know, Dan, the next time we have Vince, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his last name, Vince, the Star Trek.
Mañana.
Yeah, Mañana. Next time we have him on, remind me to ask him what his favorite Star Trek movie
sure.
is. And I've seen episodes of that. I think I've seen more of Vince's version of Star Trek than I have the actual, you know. The dude's such a great job with that, by the way, Mañana. Vince Mañana does these Star Trek episodes that are sanctioned by Star Trek, you know. Because, as we've all mentioned, the TV show was only on for 3 seasons. And it was supposed to be on. It was supposed to be on for 5. I mean, at the speech at the beginning is 5-year mission, and it was canceled after 3. So Vince wanted to do something about that. Big Star Trek fan, so he writes and directs and plays Captain Kirk, and it's called Star Trek Continues. And they use real sets. This is not just like a sort of a fan fiction kind of a thing with low. Low quality and just some goofball with a camera trying to. This is real. This is professional, real deal. He has actual actors. My friend Kipley is on it. That's Emo Phillips' wife. Kipley has been on the show in the past. Lots of really good performances and guest stars from Star Trek have been on there. So we'll get we'll talk more about that some other time when we get Vince back on here. Interesting guy too, really interesting guy. But I'd love to hear what his favorite Star Trek stuff is. We got some people who are calling in already. Here's Donald on WGN. Hi, Donald.
Hi. I remember tuning it in, when I back in 1967 and wondering, is this an Outer Limits episode?
Yeah.
But it turned into I saw the ears. Actually, the ears actually caught me, right away. And since then, I've been a big fan, and I actually went to the conventions all the time, and did a tour of the United States and different conventions, playing actually Robert Picardo's character from Voyager, which is a hot character.
Yeah.
And I met Robert Picardo at the time. We had the same height, the same everything, and one of the biggest kicks I ever had was here in Chicago's convention. I was like waving my hand to get his attention, and he says, "Oh, that nice gentleman back there with the high forehead, I admire so much." And I get up, and everybody goes, "Yeah," so that's great. And I could actually win conventions just by doing an impression of him.
Nice.
And it was amazing seeing a doppelganger like that. So those are my credentials as an expert. But I really liked seeing Wrath of Khan. When that came out, I don't think anything has topped that.
Yeah, I'm obviously, I think most people would say Wrath of Khan, especially coming after Star Trek the Motion Picture, which was such a disappointment for a lot of people.
Right. I'm seeing Ricardo Montalban, his greatest performance ever, maybe.
Oh, yeah. No, he's phenomenal in it. It's not just a great Star Trek movie. In general, it's a fantastic science fiction movie too. Just take the Star Trek out of it, it is a really great science fiction movie. So.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I actually was in costume, and I saw a screening of it, but they were doing a back screening, and just like you do with movies, and I was like, whoa, I can't believe it, I'm dressed up like one of them, and I'm watching this thing, which is so amazing,
Right, yeah. Okay, Donald, thanks for the call, man.
Thank you.
Take care. There you go, we got some Trekkies listening. Here's Julie on WGN. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Nick. Hey, I agree. Wrath of Khan, I love it. I love that movie.
Yeah.
And the other one I did was the one with the whales.
Yeah, that's the fourth one. That's the Voyage.
Yep. And that's colorful metaphors that Spock said when they were going through San Francisco.
Yeah.
When something had happened, I go, oh, this is a colorful metaphor.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah,
the
Wrath of Khan is definitely really good.
Okay, Julie, thank you.
So, okay, take care.
Take care.
Bye.
We got some texts that are coming in. 301 area code, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan is hands down the best. I think we're going to hear that a lot this morning, Dan. I think the words Wrath of Khan will be said a lot. I've been enjoying the new ones quite a bit with Chris Pine, etc. Of the Next Generation movies, the first one, First Contact, is the best. I'm trying to remember, as we go through these, I don't really remember the Next Generation ones. They don't really stick. I remember there was one that I really liked, and it was the one, and I don't know which title it is. It's the one. It's the one with the Borg, where the Borg are the bad guys in it, and And I think Patrick Stewart actually becomes a Borg at one point in the movie, if I remember correctly. That was the one that I liked the most of all of them. And I don't know what the title is, but I have all the info in front of me. 312 area code says, I agree with you, Nick. I was so let down by the first Star Trek, the motion picture. I was a huge Star Trek fan and looking forward to it. But then they spent most of the movie traversing the huge space bugle and ended up with a disappointing finish. 608 area code says that the best Star Trek movie is the fourth one, The Voyage Home. That's the one with the whales. Which is a good movie. Very entertaining movie. Well, here's what Eric Diaz says. The Star Trek franchise will have had a whopping 13 feature film entries over 36 years. It's not a small number. Only the James Bond series has more installments, and arguably the quality has been more consistent in the Star Trek features than the Bond. It's a good thing Charlie's not. Good thing Charlie Short's not here. I'm sure he'd argue that point. How did that happen, Dan? How did we discover we're talking music and then suddenly Charlie Short turns out to be the biggest James Bond fan?
I can't recall.
That was so funny.
That was fantastic, though.
You know what it was? You know how it came up? Is because Warren Zevon was a big James Bond fan, and when he was diagnosed with cancer, terminal cancer, he was like, I just want to make it long enough to see the new James Bond movie, and then they screened it for him. That's how it came up, because we were talking about Zevon. That's not to say that the series hasn't had its ups and downs quality-wise. The highs have been really high, but the lows have been pretty embarrassing. While Star Trek is primarily a television franchise, there is no doubt that many casual fans, the kind that couldn't be bothered to tune into the show each week, the movie version of Trek is the only Trek that they really know. That's me. And even for hardcore fans, the movies are special because the greater life and death events for the crew of the USS Enterprise were often saved for the films, as the TV episodes always put things back exactly where they started at the end of each episode. It's not so with the movies. Before we rank of the Star Trek films, a warning, there are major spoilers for all of these movies here. So if for some reason you know that certain characters die in movies, even decades after the said film is released, I suggest you bookmark this article, watch all the Star Trek movies, and then come back. we good? Okay, now let's get from the worst of the bunch. And that would be Star Trek Insurrection. While Star Trek The Next Generation remains my all-time favorite Trek series, without a doubt, the cast of that show had a rougher go of it on the big screen than the original crew did. It's almost like it's payback for the fact that The Next Generation ran for 7 seasons and was a ratings hit, while the original struggled with 3 seasons and only became a hit in syndication after the fact. Insurrection is one of the most embarrassing Trek movies, but it suffers from being the most boring and most small in scope. You watch it, and then it's almost instantly forgettable. From the first movie on, the Star Trek films focused on big events in the lives of the Enterprise crew, for the relaunch of the Enterprise, to Spock's death and rebirth, and so on. But Insurrection was really just a standard one-and-done episode that you had to pay for at a time when 2 other Star Trek shows were on air each week. That would be Deep Space Nine and Voyager, and they were arguably better and free. The plot of the film revolved around a planet of some sort of fountain of youth thing happening, and an aggressive alien species that wants all of it for themselves, plus the corrupt Federation admiral, because there is always one of those, and it always amounts to a snooze fest. Both the new alien species introduced in the movie are uninteresting visually. One is this weird plastic surgery obsessed species that get bizarre facelifts all the time, and the other is yet another hippy dippy humanoid species that wears a lot of cotton, the kind in the 90s era Trek that they loved way too much. Jonathan Frakes returned to direct after the successful First Contact. The script was written by the late Michael Piller, the man who saved Next Generation in its 3rd season and just couldn't make any magic happen this time. Yeah, I do remember Insurrection, and it's not good. All right, there you go. We're ranking them, the Star Trek movies from worst to first. And we'll do more of it. And we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. And we'll do more after this. Oh, yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. And we are 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. And if you would like to join us, it's 312-981-7200. My dad's going to call up and tell a joke a little bit later on because it's a jokey time. We'll tell you how you can celebrate MLK Day today. And We've got a Blackhawks Express, an actual fun Blackhawks Express, particularly fun for Jonathan Toews, and you'll hear about that a little bit later on. So, but right now we're talking about Star Trek movies. You know, Rod Pyle was with us, big Star Trek guy, big sci-fi guy, and I looked online and I saw at Nerdist, Eric Diaz ranked all 13 Star Trek movies from worst to best. And we're going to go through those, and we want to hear from you. Where do you stand on the Star Trek films? 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. So ranked last, according to Eric Diaz, was Star Trek Insurrection from 1998. And then the next one, the next worst one, is Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. Now, this one, Dan, Shatner directed. This is the one that William Shatner directed.
Okay.
And considered by most fans to be the worst of the original cast Star Trek movies, except for Mr. Scott Oaken, who maintains it's his favorite Star Trek movie. Which he's way, way, way in the minority on this one. But I can't tell you the number of times you know, like during factory, you know, during factory shows or factory productions or times that we were across the street at Chief O'Neill's, how much this would drive everybody else crazy that Scott would just with a straight face talk about how much he loves Star Trek V and it's the best of all the Star Trek movies. You know who it drove completely insane?
Who's that?
Anthony Turnis. Turnis would go nuts. He would go nuts. And it got to the point where Scott would do it. You know, he would basically do it on purpose in order to get Turnis's goat, you know. But yeah, I mean, he would take the bait every single time. Turnis would take the bait every single time. It would be like, look, he's just saying this on purpose. He's saying this on purpose just to get you going. And it worked every time. It made Turnis nuts. They would just how could you say Star Trek V is good? And they would have the same discussion and the same argument over and over and over and over and over again. And then to the point where like people would be standing at the bar going, "Will you guys shut up? I mean, I'm not even in this conversation. I've heard it 5,000 times." But I thought Star Trek V sucked. I thought it was terrible. Star Trek The Final Frontier. After chapters 3 and 4 were successfully directed by Leonard Nimoy, William Shatner wanted in on some of the directing action. Unfortunately, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier gives into all of Shatner's cheesier tendencies, and the lowbrow humor often totally conflicts with the seriousness of the main story. How serious is the main story? It actually has the Enterprise hijacked by a religious zealot who is Spock's long-lost, never-before-heard-of older brother who takes the starship on a mission to find God. Yeah, that God. From the get-go, you know this mission is going to be a failure because you know they aren't going to find God hanging out on some planet, so there's no dramatic tension. Also, because ILM was busy at the time with Indiana Jones and the Last Crusades, the effects were farmed out to a low-rent company who turned in the worst special effects in the film series thus far. Still, there is some charming stuff here. The opening sequence with Kirk, Spock, and Bones on a camping trip in Yosemite is fun, for instance. And there are a few other cute bits here and there, but when you combine it all with cheap knockoff of the cantina scene in Star Wars, Lieutenant Uhura doing a naked fan dance to distract the bad guys like in an old Tex Avery cartoon, and too much other nonsense to get into, the best thing I have to say is that thank goodness the classic crew got one more outing to get a chance to go out with some dignity, because if Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, lacks anything, it's dignity. Oh, yeah, bad movie. Really, really bad movie. And I remember Roy hosted a screening of it. I have a real bad memory attached to it because I remember I went to Roy's screening. I think it was if I remember correctly, it was at the Old Orchard. And I was working overnights at the Jewels at that time. And I remember going to see the movie and then like not napping, because normally that gives, you know, like for me, I nap in the evening sometimes, you know, unless I want to watch something like Celebrity Big Brother tonight. But So I skipped it to go see Star Trek, because the fourth Star Trek was great. The fourth one, as we mentioned before, with the whales is great. And so this was the follow-up to that, and I was excited to see what Shatner would do direct. And like 15 minutes in, I was like, oh, my God. But I remember Roy hosted it, and he hosted the screening, and he introduced the movie, and then he took off because he'd already seen it. He'd already seen it. So, and he didn't say anything to me. He didn't tell me it was bad or anything. But he had seen it already and he took off. He's like, okay, everybody enjoy the movie. Okay. Thanks. See ya. And then he's gone. Now you knew if Roy didn't stick around to watch the movie at the screening, you knew he had seen it already and he hated it. You know, he did that with a movie called Mickey and Maude. This was a Dudley Moore movie where he has two wives and they're both pregnant at the same time. And it's Anne Ryan King. And I can't remember who the other. Oh, Amy Irving. I think it was Amy Irving. Blake Edwards directed it. Blake Edwards, you know, known for, like, really great comedies. And I remember Roy hated that movie so much, but he had already agreed to host a screening of it. So they had already, you know, he was giving away tickets to the screening, and then he finally saw it at a critic screening and was like, I can't believe I'm actually going to give tickets away for this movie. And that was another one he took off, man. As soon as he did the intro, he was out of there. I don't think Mickey and Maude's that bad. There's funny stuff in it, but he hated it. I remember, man, did Roy hate that movie. But anyway, he'd hosted Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, and I'd sacrifice. I remember going straight to work afterwards, and like, you know, and I worked 11 to 7 at that time, and I remember like around that last hour, that 6 o'clock hour was tough, man. And I was like, I can't believe that I'm exhausted, I feel terrible, and I sat through that stupid Star Trek movie, and that's why I'm so tired, because I sat through a terrible Star Trek movie. Here's Ike in Country Club Hills. Hey, Ike.
Hey, Nick, how's it going with you, man? Yeah, this is a good topic, because I've always been a fan of Star Trek. Like you mentioned, Star Trek IV is my favorite, because there's some fact I'm sure you didn't know about, but first, it's my favorite because of Leonard Nimoy directed it. It was like the first big Star Trek movie that was known for humor.
Yeah, no, it's very funny. There's no question about it. It's very, very funny.
Oh, absolutely. But I'm not sure if you knew this, but the Catherine Heck character was originally supposed to be played by Eddie Murphy. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. That would have been weird.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah, that would have been weird. All right,
Yeah, it would have made it more funny, right? No problem, Nick.
Okay, take care. There you go. All right, yeah, Star Trek. Oh, that's weird. Eddie Murphy. No, I didn't know that. All right, next on the list of going from worst to best is Star Trek Nemesis. I remember when this one came out. Because we were doing Among the Dead at the time. We were doing the play Among the Dead, and I was going through like a really horrible breakup at the time. And there were some people in the cast of Among the Dead who were so excited about this one, because this was another Patrick Stewart. You know, it was another Next Generation one, and everybody was very excited about it. I remember it opened while we were doing the show, and I remember a bunch of people went to go see it, and we came in to do the Saturday night performance of Among the Dead, and everybody was just like, so disappointed. They were all like, oh, man. Because it was like a group outing. Like a whole bunch of people from the cast went, and everybody was really excited about it. And then I remember just as each one of these people came in who went to go see it the day before, I mean, you could just see that they're like, oh, man. They felt so depressed and disappointed. Although it's often ranked at the very bottom of the Star Trek movie pile by many fans, I have to admit, I really don't hate Nemesis. I mean, yes, it shamelessly rips off Wrath of Khan with another vengeance-seeking enemy, this one played by a young Tom Hardy. Did you know that, Dan?
I did know that.
A very young Tom Hardy. Called Shinzon, he is a clone of Picard who was raised in the Romulan mines, who takes over the Romulan Empire and is hell-bent on destroying his genetic father. Mostly just because the script says so. This is not a good film, but it's fairly entertaining, and I think it has a better finale for the TNG crew than Insurrection. For example, it gives fans of the show the wedding of Riker and Troy after 15 years of will they or won't they, and actually it has cameos at said wedding by cast members the movie series seemed to have forgotten. Sadly, outside of Picard and Data, who both have the whole meeting their doppelganger storyline, when Data encounters another similar style android named B4, the other characters are very shortchanged. Once again, Riker, Geordi, Worf, and Crusher are just there, aside from Deanna Troi, whose sole purpose in the film is being mind-raped by the villain's lackey for not much of a good reason. She does get some decent revenge on the rapist at the end, though. Like the previous Next Generation movie, the budget for this seems very low and barely above a TV pilot. The director, Stuart Baird, had no previous knowledge of Star Trek. In this instance, his lack of knowledge and weakness is not a strength. When Data dies in the movie, it doesn't mean anything because it's basically undone by the end of the film. At least Wrath of Khan knew to wait till the next chapter to bring Spock back. But there's some nice showy, action-y stuff in the film, and it's never really dull. Tom Hardy shows he's got acting chops. When the film ends, the last shot is not the Enterprise boldly going in Wark, but in dry dock, badly damaged. A fitting metaphor for the state of the series at that point. And this was the lowest grossing of all Star Trek movies, making only $43 million domestically, killing the franchise for 7 years. Eventually, though, Star Trek would rise from the ashes, as it always does. Yeah. Nemesis. I did see it when it came out. I thought it was bad. Now I'm curious because I would like to go back and see it just for Tom Hardy, you know, to see, you know, what it was like God, it was 18 years ago, 18 years ago. How old was he? Was he like 20 when he made that movie? Wow. It'd be interesting to see that. All right. We're going to take a break here. We got weather. And then we'll take a break and we'll come back and talk more about the Star Trek films ranked from worst to best. How old was he?
He's 41 now, so...
20?
Yeah.
Two?
22.
Wow, he was a pup. Man. All right. Hi, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call up and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. Steve Grzanich is coming up with the opening bell, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, we're talking Star Trek movies, ranked from worst to best. And next on the list, Star Trek the Motion Picture. Now, this was the very first one. This was the one, came out in 1979, and I remember seeing it at the Norwich Theater, and it was packed. It was a huge line before the movie that everybody, and people were in costume. They were all, all the Star Trek guys came out, the Trekkies or Trekkers or whatever they prefer to be called, and all of them were disappointed. So, after 10 years of false starts, with various discarded scripts, a possible new TV series called Star Trek Phase 2 that almost happened, and the start of what we think of today as fan culture, Star Trek, the motion picture, finally took flight in 1979 with a then astronomical budget of $45 million. For the most part, you saw every penny of that $45 million on screen. The effects were light years from the old show. The Enterprise looked stunning for the first time ever, and on top of that, all of the original cast returned with an A-list director, Robert Wise, at the helm. What could go wrong? Well, pretty much everything. The movie is long, it's boring, and it's a slog. It's essentially a remake of the original series episode, The Changeling, where an old 20th century Earth probe gets rewired by alien tech, becomes godlike, and returns to Earth looking for its creator, wreaking havoc along the way. Except for that old, low-budget episode, told the same story very much more efficiently and with fun and humor sprinkled in. Two things that TMP is totally missing. The witty banter from the old show is gone, replaced with the cast giving long stares at pretty lights on the view screen with what seems like forever. Instead of bright colors, everyone is in drab, white, or beige uniforms. Captain Kirk looks like he's wearing a dentist shirt for some reason. That's true, actually. Did Spock need a root canal or something? This guy's funny, man, this Eric Diaz. Spock has some of the more interesting stuff going on in story-wise in the movie and actually has an arc, but everyone else is just there. The movie made bank, though, mostly because Trek fans had waited a decade for it to happen, But the reaction to this movie almost stopped the revival of Star Trek before it started. Luckily, they had one more shot at this, and everything did end up working out. So, okay, next one on the list here is Star Trek Into Darkness. Following 2009's Star Trek, one of the most well-received reboots in recent memory, it had to be an unenviable task for all involved. Unfortunately, screenwriters Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman did almost everything wrong when writing Star Trek Into Darkness. Even the name sucks. The reason this movie is as high as it is on one of the lists is mainly this. The first hour of the film mostly works, addresses certain big issues the previous film had, like the fact that saving the world or not, Cadet Kirk was not ready to be a captain of a ship yet. The first act really hums along and has great moments. But then the movie hits its second hour and it all falls apart. Once Benedict Cumberbatch reveals his true identity and hisses at the camera that he's conned, everything just hits the wall. How did timeline disruptions turn the previously ethnic con Nguyen Sing into a pasty white British dude? Why is it his master plan that makes zero sense? There is no reason for Khan to be in this movie aside from the fact that there was once another Star Trek II that had a Khan in it. But if you're going to go to do Khan, do him right or don't do him at all. And redoing the end of Wrath of Khan, but with Kirk dying instead of Spock, and the two of them sharing that particular heartfelt goodbye moment feels totally unearned by this point in the series. Oh, and Khan has magic resurrection blood in this movie, because, yeah. I remember seeing Into Darkness, and when they do reveal that Benedict Cumberbatch is indeed playing Khan, I was furious, but there were so many people in that theater. I remember you could just feel everybody in the theater just hate what just happened. You can't, and you know, and look, I love Benedict Cumberbatch, but he's not Khan. Dan, would you cast Benedict Cumberbatch in a part that Ricardo Montalban played?
It does not seem like good casting.
No, it's not. And again, I like Benedict Cumberbatch. All right, how about this one? 301 area code says, if you ever watch any episode of the original TV series, make it the edge of the city on the edge of forever. I remember that title sticks out. You know, I think when we've talked about great Star Trek episodes, that one pops up a lot. Our good friend Bob Medea, who is our Sherlock Holmes expert, he says, I'm a huge Star Trek nerd. My favorite film is Star Trek II: Wrath of Khan, followed closely by Star Trek VI: The Undiscovered Country, which I call the Sherlock Holmes one because Spock hints at being related to Sherlock. There were three episodes of Next Generation which incorporated Sherlock Holmes, but I love the shows and movies. Not a fan of the second movie in the Chris Pine series, even though Benedict Cumberbatch is in it. Speaking of Sherlock. Kathy says, favorite movie is Voyage Home. Loved Spock's efforts to sound human. We still say double dumbass on you. And too much LSD in the 70s. Or LDS, because they get it wrong. LDS instead of LSD. LDS in our family all the time. Yeah. The fourth one's great, man. It is. It's very, very funny. And, you know, the guy who directed that and co-wrote it is a guy named Nicholas Meyer, who also directed Wrath of Khan. And I think he directed another one, too. But anyway, what's crazy is that Star Trek IV, they go back in time to San Francisco. And then they're like fish out of water there. You know, they don't know what's going on. They can't deal with where they are or, you know, all this stuff. And they're trying to, you know, save the whales and all that. But there's a lot of humor in it. It's really, really, it's the funniest of all the Star Trek movies. There's no question about it. I mean, it's huge laughs throughout most of the movie. But the thing is weird, is that Nicholas Meyer directed this movie called Time After Time, which is, I think, one of the greatest time travel movies of all time. I mean, it's just, have you seen it, Dan?
I have not. I've heard of it.
The plot is Malcolm McDowell plays H.G. Wells, and he really, not just as a sci-fi writer, but he really, in the movie, made a time machine, like for real. David Warner plays Jack the Ripper, who his identity is not known to H.G. Wells and his friends, and David Warner is like a really good friend of Malcolm McDowell's in the movie. But then it's revealed that he is indeed Jack the Ripper. Everybody is shocked, especially Malcolm McDowell. And David Warner steals the time machine and goes into the future, San Francisco. And then Malcolm McDowell follows him to modern-day San Francisco. And it's the same setting. It's the same sort of idea. For some reason, Nicholas Meyer likes to make time travel movies that involve San Francisco. And wacky, you know, like wacky fish out of water stuff. And there's so many hilarious moments in the movie because, like, he doesn't know how to hail. He doesn't know what a cab is. You know, I mean, he hails a cab and a cab, like, pulls up and almost kills him and scares the hell out of him. He eats at McDonald's, doesn't know how to order or anything. Meets Mary Steenburgen. And that's where he met her on set, and they ended up getting married. That was his second wife. And now Mary Steenburgen is, of course, married to Ted Danson. But anyway, so it was so similar because when I saw Star Trek IV, you know, knowing Nicholas Meyer's credits, but a half an hour into the movie, I'm like, man, this is just like Time After Time. This is he's basically redoing Time After Time. But with whales and Star Trek characters. I mean, it's the same. It's essentially the same, you know, covering a lot of the same terror. Doing it well. I mean, it's really good. But yeah, if you guys have not seen Time After Time, you really should. It is a really, really great film. Wholly original and just fantastic. And everybody in it is great. So, all right. Let's take a break. We got the news coming up. And then after the news, we'll talk more Star Trek movies and get the rest of them ranked right here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Welcome back. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are here until 5 a.m. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we'll tell you how you can celebrate MLK Day a little bit later on. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We got a Blackhawks Express to play back, and now we're talking Star Trek. We're talking Star Trek movies ranked from worst to best, according to Eric Diaz from Nerdist.com. He ranked Star Trek Insurrection as the worst. Then Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, Star Trek Nemesis, Star Trek The Motion Picture, Star Trek Into Darkness, and now we're at number 8 on the list, Star Trek Generations. So this is the first of the Next Generation movie, the first one with that cast. And here's what he says about it. There is a lot about Star Trek Generations, the first big screen outing with the TNG crew, that just doesn't work. Even the film's writers Ron Moore and Brannon Braga admit as much on the film's DVD commentary. The pair of writers who had just finished the Next Generation's final episode, All Good Things, one of the best final episodes of any show ever, decided to keep doing the opposite of what fans desired and expected with the story instead of giving fans what they wanted. But sometimes it's best not to give the people what they want. Instead of being introduced to the Next Generation crew in the big action set piece, we are instead introduced to them in the cheesy holodeck scene on a boat. Instead of Picard being the stoic commander in his first movie outing, he's seen mostly suffering and crying at the loss of his brother and his nephew who die off screen. All of this would be fine if it weren't for just an episode of The Next Generation, but this is a big screen debut, and you don't want Jean-Luc blubbering all over his photo album in the first movie outing. Having said that, Generations isn't boring and has some genuinely fun moments. The opening scene featuring the launch of the Enterprise B shows Shatner's Kirk in his last heroic moment, proving why he's the prototypical Starship captain. As with most Trek movies, this is what I remember. Here's what I remember about Star Trek Generations. Shatner gets two death scenes in it. Because it's Shatner. You know, I'm sure Shatner probably said, I want two death scenes. I don't want just one. I want two. That was the one thing that I remember the most from the movie, because they kill off Kirk at the beginning, and then I guess there's a time travel thing, and they kill him off again at the end. So, let's see. As with most Trek movies, this movie contains major moments in the lore of the series, keeping it from being just an episode on the big screen. Data finally gets emotions, and all those scenes with Brent Spiner coping with new feelings are gold. Also, cool is the destruction of the Enterprise D, which gets blown up real good, just as finally Malcolm McDowell is the villain. Soren is okay. He's neither the best nor worst Trek baddie. Falls squarely in the middle. His whole villain plot is to get into some vaguely defined paradise dimension called the Nexus is pretty lame, though. But the scenes with the Nexus, within the Nexus, with Captains Picard and Kirk meeting face-to-face are pretty fun, even if you desperately wish that they were on the Enterprise together and not some ranch somewhere cooking breakfast and riding horses. Generation should have been a much better film, but the one we ended up with is hardly the worst thing in the world. Yeah, I remember not liking it. That's what I remember. Next, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. There is a longstanding notion that the Star Trek films in the original series, that the odd-numbered ones are bad entries and the even-numbered ones are good. That's been the theory for a long, long time. At the end of Wrath of Khan, that's mostly true, but there's one exception to that rule, and that is The Search for Spock. At the end of Wrath of Khan, it was pretty obvious that the producers were giving themselves an out should they decide to bring Nimoy back as Mr. Spock. So the fact that some fans acted like it was out of the blue, cheap cop-out, it seems ridiculous to me. I mean, the final shots of Khan pretty much spell out that the next movie will revolve around it. The best thing about 3 is that the producers realized that if Spock were to come back to life story-wise, there would have to be major repercussions for Kirk and company. So sure, Spock comes back at the end of the film, which Leonard Nimoy actually directed, but at what price? Kirk loses so much to get his friend back by the end of the movie. Spock may be breathing, but the Enterprise is destroyed, his son is killed, and his career is in ruins, all to save the life of his best friend, which he may not even remember for all he knows. It's touching, powerful stuff, and it gives the whole movie a satisfying through line. The film's villain, Christopher Lloyd, is still the most ruthless Klingon of all time as Kruge, the best bad guy the Enterprise crew after Khan. The only problem with Star Trek III, in my book, is that it's just not perfect as Wrath of Khan, and that's it. Okay? And Robin Curtis is not very good as the half-Vulcan Lieutenant Savick, and as Kirstie Alley was in the part, whom she was replaced for this film. But that's one tiny complaint, and this movie is truly satisfying from start to finish. So we like Star Trek III, Wrath of Khan. You know, what I remember about Star Trek III, and I think this was another, I'm almost positive this was another Roy screening. I think Roy hosted all the Star Trek movies. I think he hosted all the Star Trek movie screenings. So I remember seeing this one, and I'm not, as we've discussed, I'm not a Trekkie. I never watched the show. And so at the very end of the movie, this is the only thing I remember. I mean, I remember thinking the movie wasn't very good. I didn't like it very much. And I've since seen it again, and I like it. Now I like it. But I remember in the theater, which was packed with Star Trek people, you know, with Trekkies, no question about it. That was, you know, you could just tell. At the end of the movie, because what happens is they bring Spock back. They put him on this planet, and he is like, he comes back to life, but as a child, and then he grows, you know, into adulthood. And then at the end of the movie, he's Leonard Nimoy. Like, you finally get to see him as Leonard Nimoy. And people are wondering, you know, like, because what has this done to him? Has it changed Spock? Is he different? How's he going to react? Is he going to remember anybody? You know. So at the very end of the movie, they say something to Spock. Somebody says something. I think Shatner says something to Spock. And then Spock just raises his eyebrow. And I'm not kidding you. The place went nuts in the theater. Old Orchard Theater. All he did was raise the eyebrow, and people were screaming. It was absolute chaos. Just cheers, and I'm like, what the hell is going on? But I mean, that's like the signature thing that means he's okay. That was Spock's way of letting everybody know it's okay. I got the eyebrow thing going. I know what's going on. And I just remember the crowd going nuts. I remember it was like of all of the things that happened in that movie, there's a lot of special effects, a lot of action, you know, and that was the thing that people, I thought the ceiling was going to fall in the theater. So next is Star Trek Beyond. This is one we mentioned a little bit earlier. After the tepid fan response of Star Trek Into Darkness, J.J. Abrams stepped back as director, but remained as producer for the third part of the adventures of the Enterprise crew in the rebooted universe. Fast and Furious director Justin Lin came on board, and between all the explosions and motorcycles popping wheelies in the trailers, everyone thought it was going to be Star Trek in name only. But that couldn't have been further from the truth. Beyond, despite all the heavy action, is very much in the vein of the original series and ethos, and it finally gets the Enterprise away from the vicinity of Earth and out exploring the galaxy. Taking place 3 years into the crew's five-year mission, exactly where the original series left off, Kirk and company have fallen into a routine. Then, and out of nowhere, a surprise attack from an unknown species forces the Enterprise to crash land in a totally unknown world. The assault came from Krall, played by Idris Elba, an alien commander who needs a valuable artifact that's aboard the Enterprise. With nothing but their gumption and their will to survive, the crew must now battle a deadly alien race while trying to find their way off of this hostile world. At first, Krall seems to be like a generic alien villain, but a reveal in the movie paints him in a whole new light and makes him much more interesting than he first appears. And while destroying the Enterprise is a cliche at this point, it serves the story in a big way, as the crew have to discover who they are to each other without the confines of the ship. And the alien warrior woman, Jala, played by Sophia Boutella, is also a welcome addition to the cast. Yeah, she's great. She's really great. As the movie was meant to celebrate 50 years of Star Trek, it hit all the right notes, and here's hoping that it's not the last journey for Pine and Quinto as Kirk and Spock. So there it is. Yeah, that was a good one. Beyond was really good. I enjoyed that. All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll finish this up, and then we'll talk a little bit about MLK Day as well. We'll finish off with the top five Star Trek movies, and we want to hear from you if you're a Trekkie, or what do you, where do you stand on these movies? 312-981-7200. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and my main man, Steve Cochran, at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And we're talking about Star Trek movies. A really fun piece written by Eric Diaz from Nerdist.com. We're talking about the best Star Trek movies. He ranked them from worst to best. And we are getting near the top five here. We are, in fact, in the top five. Number five on his list, moving up, is Star Trek First Contact. While the TNG crew had a rough time of it with their entries in the movie series, they got one genuine classic out of the bunch with First Contact. In many ways, the film borrows from the best of the original series, features films before it, but does so in a good way. Sequel to a beloved TV episode? Check. A Moby Dick-inspired revenge story, a la Wrath of Khan? Check. Time travel, like Voyage Home? Check. They ticked off all the right boxes. The plot has the Federation nemesis, the Borg, go back in time to an... Oh, this is the one with the Borg. Okay, so this is the one, that I liked. To stop the first contact between the Vulcans and humanity before stopping the Federation from ever forming, Picard and the crew of newly minted Enterprise E go back to stop them from interfering with the first ever warp flight carried out by Zefren Cochrane, played by veteran actor James Cromwell. Oh, yeah! I forgot James Cromwell was in this one, man. This is a good one. Who is a welcome addition to the cast, as is Alfred Woodard as his assistant Lily, Alice Creege as the Borg Queen, even gives a bad idea on paper, giving the Borg collective an individual leader and a pretty spectacular result. Although technically an ensemble film, this is really a Picard movie through and through. The captain has to get through his own anger and trauma at what the Borg did to him on the TV series when they assimilated him into a collective and made him locutus, causing hundreds of deaths, and Patrick Stewart just brings it. When he hisses out, "The line must be drawn here, this far, no further," you know he means business. Commander Riker himself, Jonathan Frakes, directed this entry, and he gives almost everyone in the crew something to do that matters to the story, but never forgets that it's chiefly a Jean-Luc Picard story. This is the TNG writing, directing, and acting staff firing on all cylinders, and it never got better than this for them on the big screen. Let's see. 765 area code sends his top five. Wrath of Khan, First Contact, Undiscovered Country, The Voyage Home, and A Search for Spock. 815 area code says Star Trek The Motion Picture was very disappointing. Best is Wrath of Khan. I also liked Undiscovered Country. 608 area code says Star Trek II was an extended story of Space Seed. Star Trek IV was an original idea and very creative. Yep, now we're up to Star Trek IV, The Undiscovered Country. After Star Trek V got horrible reviews and underwhelming box office, the prevailing thought at Paramount was to reboot the original characters with a set of younger actors, giving the Enterprise crew an origin story. But with the 25th anniversary of the franchise around the corner, wiser heads prevailed at the studio and decided that William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and the rest of the original crew had one more movie left in them, and they deserved a good swan song. Wrath of Khan's Nicholas Meyer returned to direct, working from a story that he and Leonard Nimoy concocted, and together they made sure that Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, was the finale the original crew deserved. Like the best of the classic series, this entry used real-world situations as the basis for the story, in this case, the fall of the Berlin Wall, with the Klingon Empire standing in for the USSR. Combining the allegorical element with a wonderful whodunit aboard the Enterprise and a great villain in Christopher Plummer's Klingon Commander Chang, all of the right ingredients came together for a terrific movie and a great finale for the original series crew. Number three is Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Having gone through life, death, and life again together, the Enterprise crew needed to lighten up a bit, and they did with Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Using two of the most oft-used tropes of the original series, time travel and social commentary, this entry in the series winds up working on almost every level, but that's mostly because after all the high drama in the previous two installments, they decided a little comedy was what the series needed, and they were right. But just because it's funny doesn't mean it's not an interesting story going on. The alien probe comes to Earth and wreaks havoc because the humpback whale species they're trying to communicate with is now long extinct. The Enterprise crew dishonored in a rusty old Klingon bird of prey after the events of the previous film, go back in time to bring the whales into their future in an effort to save Earth. It sounds silly on paper, but it all works like gangbusters on screen. The humor in the film is smart and not slapsticky, and Save the Whales commentary works, but it doesn't feel ham-fisted. Leonard Nimoy returned to the director's chair for this one, proving Star Trek III was no fluke, and thus began a long feature film directing career. Nicholas Meyer also helped the story as well. For years, this was the most popular Star Trek movie at the box office because, fan or not, it's just a great time at the movies. And also makes entries 2, 3, and 4 form a nice little trilogy. Had the original series ended there, it would have not been the worst thing. Coming in at number 2, this is pretty high on the list, is the J.J. Abrams 2009 version of Star Trek. Wow. Coming in higher than the whales. When J.J. Abrams' big screen reboot of Star Trek came out, the franchise was dead as a doornail. The previous TV series, Enterprise, was never really clicked with viewers and was the first Trek show to get canceled since the original. The prevailing thought was that Star Trek as a franchise had its day. Then J.J. comes along and reinvigorates the film series with an incredibly rewatchable and fun entry, one that gives the classic Enterprise crew the origin story they never had before, and finds a way to give Leonard Nimoy Spock a proper swan song as well. Star Trek 09 became the biggest grossing film in the franchise, and it's even adjusted for inflation. None of this would have worked if the recasting of the original crew wasn't as impeccable as it was. They had giant boots to fill, and everyone from Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, right down to Anton Yelchin as Chekhov do their best to evoke the original characters without resorting to impersonations. Okay, maybe Carl Urban is doing a Bones impression, but it's so good, I don't care. there are tons of callbacks to the original series in the first round of films, and it feels very clever. The story moves at a crackling pace, and even if it's ridiculous that James Kirk goes from cadet to captain over the course of one film, J.J. works his magic. The movie gets some hate from hardcore Trek loyalists, but I think it's just sour grapes that their once cult franchise was fodder for a movie that was mainstream and crowd-pleasing as this one. And then number one, we've mentioned it already many times, and I think most people would agree with this. According to Eric Diaz at Nerdist, it's Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which I think is absolutely the best Star Trek movie. The second Star Trek feature film should have been a total cluster. Paramount had several different scripts that they were considering, and they couldn't find one that they liked. Leonard Nimoy adamantly did not want to come back as Spock after the last film didn't satisfy him, and threatened to fire his agent if he ever mentioned the word Star Trek to him again. The budget was going to be significantly lower than the previous film. All of this was a recipe for disaster. But then, producer Harv Bennett hired a young genius named Nicholas Meyer to direct, who had recently directed the time travel thriller Time After Time, and he managed to perform a miracle. He took the best elements of the various scripts they had, one about the return of TV series villain Khan, another about a Genesis device that creates worlds, one about Kirk's long-lost son, and put them all together into one amazing script. This was now a story about aging and death, the mistakes of the past coming back to haunt you, and the sacrifices one makes in the name of friendship. Meyer weaved in a great death scene to lure Nimoy back, and it turned into one of the actor's finest moments. At that killer, Moby Dick-inspired revenge story is a sublime villain played by Ricardo Montalban, a submarine-like battle in a nebula, and a great score by the late James Horner. You have not only the best Star Trek movie of all time, but one of the best science fiction films of all time, period. Star Trek II Wrath of Khan saved the franchise. Without it, we wouldn't have had the film series, much less a Next Generation or any other Star Trek series on TV. Spock's death resulted in a new life for the franchise, and the franchise has been chasing Khan ever since. Both Nemesis and Into Darkness try to ape this movie way too much, but the film set a high bar. Neither of those two movies could ever come close to this movie's perfection. It almost certainly would. No matter how many Star Trek movies come down the pipeline in the years to come, The Wrath of Khan will remain the gold standard. Yeah. So, good list. Nice job. I remember I saw Wrath of Khan at the old Esquire Theater on Rush near, or on Oak near Rush. And I remember it was at that point, it was like the loudest movie I'd ever seen. The sound was ridiculous. I mean, they had the Dolby crazy 70, it was in 70 millimeter to Dolby sound. I just remember going, my God, this is the loudest movie I've ever seen in my life, and loved it. So I was in high school when that one came out. That was a good movie. All right, there you go. Check out Nerdist.com if you want to read the entire article. All right, we're going to take a break. We got the news coming up, and then we're going to talk about MLK Day and how you can celebrate. We got some suggestions for you. And then my dad's going to call in and tell a joke in a little bit, too. Okay, news is up after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on Wacker, and we're downtown Chicago here till 5 a.m. And Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5, and my main man Steve Cochran with your morning drive at 6. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and we have a very pleasant and exciting Blackhawks Express to play back from yesterday's game, particularly exciting for Mr. Jonathan Toews, who had quite a game yesterday. So this is going to be a fun one to listen back to. So that's coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk or text if you want to jump in here. Today is MLK Day, and we've got some ways for you can celebrate Martin Luther King Day for kids and adults. There's books, there's movies, parades, and this is how you can bring meaning to your Martin Luther King Day holiday. Here are some of the things that are suggested here to celebrate this day. Go deeper into MLK's speeches. Dr. Michael J. Durfee, assistant professor of history, director of Africana Black Studies, a minor at Niagara University, calls our immediate attention, recommends reading some of MLK's powerful but lesser known speeches and writings. King dedicated his address to what he called the most pressing problem facing humanity, poverty of spirit, which stands in glaring contrast to our scientific and technological abundance, says Durfee. As technology, economic inequality, and political polarization cleave us today, still today, we must consider what constitutes a wealthy society. King's war on poverty remains unfulfilled, as does his vision that society learn, quote, the simple art of living together as brothers. So you can access an archive on King's speeches at www.drmartinlutherkingjr.com. DrMartinLutherKingJr.com. That's DR. DrMartinLutherKingJr.com. So they get. I'm sure there's there's a ton to choose from in terms of like the content, the speeches and stuff. So that's one thing you can check out, MLK's speeches. How about this? Organize or participate in giving a giving march. MLK was devoted to helping form a respectful, diverse community. Take this as a chance to get out of your comfort zone and interact with people that you may not be involved with on a daily basis. I organized a giving march on MLK Day to remind others one of the most important beliefs Dr. King stood for, and that's making sure everyone felt loved and equal while showing children of all ages the importance of giving and gratitude. That's Jada Atkinson, the founder of Love Lives Foundation. We met in downtown Atlanta, marched up Peachtree Street, giving food and spreading joy to anyone who wanted to receive it. Our final stop was the Gateway Shelter, where we provided lunch, toiletries, and household goods to individuals transitioning to permanent housing. It was one of the best giving experiences ever. So that's nice. You can organize or do a giving march. That's Jada Atkinson. Had a very satisfying experience doing that. Attend a local MLK parade with kids. If you're home with the kids, this is a great opportunity to enlighten them to the civil rights movement and King's pioneering work. Melinda Harris, a franchise field consultant at Chicago's Children's Lighthouse, notes that there are many ways to impart the meaning of MLK Day with children. So attend an MLK parade in your town. Explain to children in a developmentally appropriate way why the people are celebrating the life of MLK. Help them to understand that no matter what someone looks like, the work of MLK supported people's right to be valued as an individual. Though Harris recommends that this is a great activity for kids, anyone interested in celebrating the legacy of MLK should consider this. The best way to find a parade in your vicinity is just to do a Google search. If you're in the metropolis, you'll probably find several options. Are there parades? Are there parades today?
I don't think there's anything locally, but I'll do a quick search.
Because it's pretty cold outside. So, how about this? Take in an MLK documentary or film. Chloe Robinson, a professor and assistant department chair of Purdue University Global, encourages her adult students to spend time reflecting on the holiday. If you're not willing or able to get out and about, you can do this by watching a relevant documentary, film, or reading a book. King challenged the narrative about race in our country and has helped us recognize the beauty in embracing diversity, says Robinson. The Eyes on the Prize documentary series and the movie Selma are all great places to start if you want to reflect on MLK's contributions to America.
Looks like the MLK parades are typically in the warm weather states like right. Texas, Florida, Arizona, but there is also one in Washington, D.C.
Dan, have you seen the movie Selma?
I have not.
It's really good. Really terrific movie. Eyes on the Prize, I've seen that too. Great documentary. Those are both great suggestions if you want to watch that. All right. Watch a program with kids that highlight diversity and then break out the crayons. If you're gathering around the TV with kids who may be too young to fully grasp the holiday, choose a program that showcases diversity. Try sitting down with them to watch television shows that feature diverse casts, says Harris. Programs that show a diverse group of characters living their daily lives together and working together to solve challenges are perfect. Watch the program together. Be prepared to answer questions like, why does his mommy have dark skin and his daddy have light skin? Following the viewing with some art time together, provide crayons and markers with a variety of skin tone colors and have fun drawing family portraits together. That sounds fun. Yeah. Books galore for all ages. You have no shortage of books that can help impart King's legacy on and lasting importance. For children ages 5 to 8, Kira Pride, head librarian at Stratford School, recommends Enough, 20 Protesters That Changed America by Emily Easton. Enough is what it's called. Emily Easton, E-A-S-T-O-N. This book is a great springboard for discussions about what it means to make an impact and how Martin Luther King Jr. was one of the many individuals who changed America. Middle grade readers with interest in superheroes may appreciate books like The Stupendous Adventures of Mighty Marty Hayes by Laura L. Hyler, H-Y-L-E-R. I feature American history through black spies and key figures such as Ruby Bridges and Josephine Baker, along with Dr. King, says Hyler. Since my novel's March 2018 publication, I've enjoyed at school visits, book festivals, education and library conferences all over the country. The kids' eyes light up when I note that Dr. Martin Luther King is part of the book. And for adults, you've got Protest at Selma, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That's by David J. Garrow. Another one that's recommended is Let the Trumpet Sound by Stephen B. Oates. The Words of African-American Heroes by Clara Villarosa. And As I Rise, Black America Since MLK by Henry L. Gates and Kevin M. Burke. And then for young kids, Let the Children March by Monica Clark Robinson, illustrated by Frank Morrison. My Daddy, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. by Martin Luther King III, illustrated by A.G. Ford. And then for teens, March Book 1 by John Lewis and Andrew Aydin, A-Y-D-I-N, illustrated by Nate Powell. And if you're in the mood for a gripping novel, check out Oprah Book Club 2018 pick, An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. So those are just a few of the books that you can check out in celebrating MLK Day. You can visit your local library. Local libraries are actually closed today, but you can. It doesn't mean you have to just one day to visit your local library. You can do that anytime.
Right, and it's the Chicago public libraries are closed today, but not necessarily throughout the state.
Right. Oh, yeah, Chicago public libraries are closed. Right. Many are hosting special MLK events. If you have the time, take an opportunity to actually go to a library or a bookstore on MLK Day with your kids to select reading material. Help your child find books that identify with themselves and that those of that are different from them, says Harris. Many public libraries are hosting MLK Day events, activities, and exhibits that are great for kids. Take for example the Milwaukee Public Library's itinerary. Check your local branch to see if they're doing something special. How about this one? Plant a tree as a symbol of growth. Vernick Potat, CFO of Plantagram.com, planted a tree with her children a few years back on MLK Day. Her motivation wasn't only to sow a symbol of growth, but also to build a positive association with her children. Now, every time my kids go apple picking, they remember Martin Luther King Jr.'s greatness and what he stood for, which is change. And then finally, we're in a tense time. Trust the process. This is one of the more chaotic times we've known as a nation in the days since King was among us. Perhaps the most important thing you can do this MLK Day is to believe. Believe and trust that these turbulent days are a necessary phase in our collective growth as a society. In the closing words of his Nobel Peace Address, King reminded the world, in spite of the tensions and uncertainties of this period, something profoundly meaningful is taking place. Old systems of exploitation and oppression are passing away, and out of the womb of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born. So uncertain times, while scary, they're also an opportunity for growth and meaningful change and healing. All positive things to think about on this day. So some suggestions for MLK Day. Have a good one and celebrate. Okay, let's take a quick break here. We've got some weather, and then my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and we've got a Blackhawks Express to play back, too. And I'm going to tell you about my my next film club screening as well. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, light snow flurries in the morning, peaks of sun after daybreak and a high near 17. Tonight, partly cloudy and a low around 3. For tomorrow, a rain snow mix and a high of 36. For Wednesday, mostly cloudy and a high near 32. Thursday, more clouds and a high near 21. It's currently 7 degrees at O'Hare. It's 9 at Midway, and it's 12 at the lakefront. All right. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, my dad will tell a joke right here on 720 WGN because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Yeah. That's right, everybody. It's time for a joke. My dad calls in and tells a joke every Monday morning. It's not Monday morning without it, and because it's a jokey, jokey time. So also coming up at 5 is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. Let's say hello to my dad here on a Monday morning. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
How you doing?
Doing good.
Good. How's Ma?
Good.
Good. All right. You got a joke.
Had a joke. He said for months a little boy had been pestering his father to take him to the zoo. Eventually, dad gives in and off they go. When they get back the mother says, asks this little boy, said, "Did you have a good time?" And he said, "I had a great time," said the little boy. "And daddy had fun too, especially when the animal came home at 30 to 1.
All right.
Dan, you like that one, huh, Dan?
I was not expecting that one. That is fantastic.
Yeah, that's a good one, Dad. All right, 30 to 1. That's a good odds. That's a long shot.
Yes, they are.
That's a long shot. All right,
that's
Dan.
A real long shot.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, thank you.
Good job, man. That's funny. You know what's really funny is that... what's really funny about that is when I was a kid, my dad took me to the track a lot.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Good luck charm.
By the time I was like 10, I knew Maywood, I knew Arlington, I knew all of them. Balmoral, I just, you know.
You ever win any cash? Did he allow you to place bets?
Yes, I did, yeah. And, you know, he and my uncle, you know, his brother, big time track guys. I mean, they used to play the horses a lot, and as a result I played the horses a lot too. And Arlington, by the way, is the most beautiful. That's the most beautiful. It's just, place is so beautiful, even if you're not gonna play the ponies or anything, but that's a beautiful place. It really is. So anyway, do we have this thing?
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
Yeah, that's right. He'll do it again next week, and we do it every Monday morning right at the same time here on 720 WGN. All right, the Blackhawks played yesterday. It was an early game, one of those 11:30 games, and it turned out great. Wow. And listen to this. This is going to be a fun Blackhawks Express, and also a really, really, really good day for Jonathan Toews, who... you know, as of recently, could use a good day. So here we go. All right, Dan, what do we got going tomorrow?
We will have Dick DiBartolo.
Oh, outstanding.
Yes.
Outstanding. Our good buddy Dick DiBartolo from Mad Magazine, and he's the gizmo guy.
Recapping Consumer Electronics Show and his best and worst gadgets of 2018.
Awesome. That'll be great. He's fantastic. Always a thrill to have him on. So there you go. That's what's coming up. Dick DiBartolo tomorrow right here on 720 WGN. All right, stay tuned, everybody. Thank you guys for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with Two for Tuesday, as well as Dick DiBartolo. But all right, the opening bell is coming up next. Stay tuned.